call the meeting of LaSard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council to order on November 13th. The first thing on our agenda is to approve, review, and approve our agenda. There's a motion for approval.
And then I would, with the chair's permission, I would like to add an agenda item, if possible. An issue regarding the public recreation information map and how the parcels that are acquired in fee, if they are included in those public recreation maps, and if they're not, what we can do to ensure that they are. So I'd like to add that as an agenda item, Mr. Chair's permission.
It's up to the group.
With the group's permission.
You're asking for an amendment and agenda. Yes. Is there any discussion on the request? All in favor of adding Scott's agenda item? Signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We'll do that after the discussion of the draft accomplishment plan, if that's all right.
Fabulous.
Anything else on the agenda? If not, a motion to approve the agenda as amended. All in favor?
Aye.
Great. You have in front of you the minutes of our meeting on September 21st. I assume you've all read them in great detail, and Don will make a motion to approve.
Motion to approve.
Thank you. Any discussion, corrections, concerns? Jane.
Handout for the direct services from the DNR.
Okay.
It mentions the old score, which is the direct services packet here. Must be in here. It was 04 on the proposal. It was for the advances for extraordinary costs, the $50,000.
Okay.
I see it on there being carried on their direct services, but I didn't see it in the minutes.
You saw it on the direct services, but not in the minutes. Can you help me understand what you're...
Yeah, I'm not ready here. I'm sorry. Could you help me find the direct services package part? Agenda item, what is that? Direct services. Mine?
Yeah.
Okay.
Below the paper.
High priority free transaction services.
6D.
6D. But I don't see it referenced in the minutes from September 21st.
Mr. Chair, if you look on the last page of the back page.
Thank you. I have no questions.
Very good.
Thank you for reading the minutes.
Yeah.
I thought I had.
Other than except the last page.
I guess.
Any other questions, concerns? All in favor of approving the minutes?
Aye.
Motion carries. I should mention Ryan is not with us. He had a business trip out of state and let us know in advance he wouldn't be here. So just a FYI here. This is a chance for anyone to declare conflicts of interest. I think there's been a declaration of conflicts in the past on specific projects, and those notifications of conflict would carry. Are there any new conflicts that anybody has discovered or have come up since our last meeting on any of this, any action that you might take to continue the right direction? So, Bill.
Thank you. In your packet, there are some items I'd like to direct your attention to under the Executive Director's Report. As you know, statute requires individuals who acquire land with outdoor heritage funds to provide us with a transaction report on the acquisition. You see such a report from the Trust for Public Lands directed to LCCMR and LSOHC is directed to us jointly because of an acquisition that was jointly funded. It is a five-page report. The meat of the report is on page 4 and 5. Page 4 lays out the funding. Half of page 5 discusses the fees. And the last two paragraphs of the, excuse me, the next to the last paragraph discusses their expenses. So if you read those paragraphs in detail, you'll see that they collected approximately $675,000 in a fee, and they had $280,000 in expenses, so were to the good $400,000. Also in your package, you can find a new and revised Minnesota Open Meeting Law discussion. Deb Dyson, this is your nighttime reading. It's tough getting to sleep, but you're welcome to read this. I want to point out that we've made the syllabus here. They point out that we have special dispensation with regard to getting information while on tours and on buses and other conveyances, thanks to staff. So that's the executive director's report. Just a quick report on what we've been doing since the last meeting. We've been working with program managers to get their accomplishment plans in shape and preparing for this meeting today. Anything else you can think of, Heather? And we are finalizing the computer system, the development of the final reports. Our first year appropriations are just now all winding up, so we'll be getting in reports from them. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Jim.
So I didn't understand, what is this document here from the Trust for Public Land?
In the statute, an entity acquiring land with the Outdoor Heritage Fund must, after the acquisition is complete, file a report on the transaction, the purchase, that lays out all transaction costs, all donations, things of that sort, so that you get a full financial picture of what happens with the acquisition. This is the report for the Trust for Public Land with regard to LaSalle Lake State Recreation Area acquisition.
And so why was it singled out to bring before us?
Bring all of the ones that I've received personally.
But one of these is generated for every acquisition that's done?
Yes. Most of them are extremely simple.
Thank you. When an NGO gets an appropriation and they do, like, five acquisitions, if they're all complete, can they put all five of those in one report, or do they generate five individual separate reports for those acquisitions?
Mr. Chair, the statute says it's to be reported on an acquisition basis. As long as you can decipher the cost per acquisition, they can put as many of them on the same sheet, but you've got to lay out the cost per each acquisition.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Bill or any other staff?
You have in front of you a preliminary schedule. It says that this is an action item. The truth is that this is nothing more than an advisory. At this point, there will obviously be some, or very likely be some new members joining the council next year. I would think it would be fairly inappropriate to approve a final agenda unless all the members are here and can weigh in on whether or not it makes sense for their schedules.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I wanted to point out that from our last adopted schedule, which was adopted before the adjournment signed on, we had adopted January 8th as the as a meeting date. That turns out to be the start of session. We will probably be reconsidering January 8th, and the question may be whether to meet the first couple of weeks in January or delay the action of that council until March the 15th. We checked the records, and the appointments weren't in until late after the end of January last time. So March 15th may be required in order to ensure that the new membership elects the new council leadership, and the new membership addresses the call for request.
So, just as FYI, we probably won't have a January 8th meeting.
Probably not.
And I guess the question for the council here is, does anyone see a need to have that meeting on January 8th, or should we just cancel it right now?
Cancel it.
Is there any opposition to canceling the January 8th?
What was the purpose of that particular meeting, though?
Finalize FY14 priorities, authorize executive committee to approve the final call, and to elect the new leadership.
So there's nothing on there that requires action at that time?
No. We can all wait as long as far as we delay up to March 15th.
And you want an extra meeting?
Since this is not this hasn't been approved yet, I'm assuming you just need a consensus one way or the other, and I'm going to say that, wait, there's no reason to have one.
Does anyone feel strongly we should have a January 8th meeting?
Just a comment. If the appointees are not identified until the end of January, isn't it kind of having a headless council for about 3 months in a very active time with the legislature?
I'll publicly admit that we set the schedule to encourage the appointing authorities to appoint in a timely fashion.
Hopefully they'll listen to you.
It did work.
Do we need a motion to cancel it?
We don't need a motion to cancel it. Just assume the meeting is no longer going to take place. Okay. Your chair has made a decision on your behalf. Next item is number 7, partial condemnation, Forest for the Future. You received in your packet and a memo on this. It's essentially the utility wants to put a new power line covering property that is was purchased. The easement was purchased with money that we allocated. As per the procedure, it has to come back to us. Most of this property is along the road, and we can have testimony on it, or we can just approve it. We will see a slight amount of money come back to us as part of that. Scott?
I would like to make a motion to approve.
Is there any other discussion on this? Bill?
Chair, we've got this before, correct?
We have had this before. This is actually, in my opinion, better than the one we had before because it's mostly along the road.
Mr. Chair, statute requires us to give 15 days notice. This was November the 6th that we gave notice to the chairs of the Environment, Finance, and Policy Committees. We have to delay action until the 11th of December. This was to make that action go smoother on the 11th of December. So this will be back up in front for formal action on the 11th of November and December.
So you're withdrawing your motion, Scott?
I'm gladly withdrawing my motion.
But I don't think we require any additional discussion or testimony, so you don't have to come next time.
Unless you really want to. All right. Next on the agenda is a discussion on the Fond du Lac band's request, was FA04. You've all received the letters that I received on this, and you received a short note from me that I had gone up and met with the chair of the band as well as some of the other staff. I want to give you a little bit of sense of my take on this before I open it up for discussion. We had, as part of our process, this request, when it came in, it received 7 votes asking for an allocation. There was a question that was raised by staff and by me early on about whether or not there was a problem with the requirements that we have made of all groups that are buying land that they can live with the deed restrictions. And because of the tribal trust status, we weren't sure if that was going to be a problem. So we asked the tribe to clarify that. They very quickly clarified that they could live with the deed restrictions. And we had that information prior to our discussion at our meeting where we made the allocation. We then had the chair's proposal, and this project was not above the line per se, based on the numerical way that we have done this. But we did have a motion to include it. And we had a subsequent discussion about that, which was focused on whether or not there would be differing hunting rights for members of the band and the general public. And to my recollection, that was the entire discussion that we had about the project. And there was no discussion about the value of the project or the conservation value of the project. The decision of this group was not to fund the project. We received subsequent a letter from the band saying they didn't think that we had followed our own criteria in making that decision. And I felt that it was appropriate for me as the chair to go up and meet with the band and discuss it with them. I did that. We had a very reasonable and pleasant meeting. They certainly have their perspective on this, which I respect. I think from their side, we didn't use the criteria that we had in front of us to make a decision, because we had no discussion about our criteria, only about a criteria that we wanted to talk about as a group, which was the hunting and fishing rights. I will say I have resisted as a member of the council going out and looking at projects, because there's no land that I don't like. You know, it's one of the hazards of loving this work. It's really hard to see property that you think shouldn't be protected. I did go out after my discussion with the band and looked at this project, and I can tell you it is a ridgetop to ridgetop basin with a lake in the middle of it with a fish. We scared up grouse on the walk out. There's really no structures visible anywhere on the property other than one that had been there some time ago and was the foundation was left. It is a stunning piece of property. From a conservation value, I have no doubt that it is a great piece of property. The band has asked us to do 2 things. And I think frankly, they seem reasonable. One, for us to look at, in the future, whether or not requests for tribal ownership would be something that we would affirm in advance would be possible, knowing that there is a difference between the hunting and fishing rights for tribal members and non-tribal members. There's a lot of history, which I only begin to understand in terms of where those tribal rights for band members came from and how it's gone through the legal process over the years. I'm sure there's some stuff in your packet about that. I'm sure we could spend a long, long time going through the detail of all of that. But they've asked for some affirmation that we would in the future fairly consider requests from tribes where the tribes would end up owning the property. The second thing they've asked for is if the November forecast, which is now likely to happen in late November, early December. The November forecast isn't anymore.
The November forecast comes out in December.
Great. That's not what business does. But that if there's extra money at that time, that we consider an allocation to this project. They have not asked us to undo allocations that we have already made and reallocate to them, which I think is a very reasonable position. Personally, I think we made a mistake. I think we did not do justice to our process. I think we should take it very seriously and be very deliberate about how we handle this request. I think we, as your chair, I think I did not do an adequate job of teeing up this issue or understanding the issue and the complexity of it well enough that we were going through the allocation to stop the process and force us to have a better discussion than we had. And for that, I apologize to everybody. So Jim and I have talked. One of the huge difficulties of operating as the council as we do is the open meeting law, and my inability to call each and every one of you and have this private conversation about my feelings, or you to talk to other members is a difficult thing for us to work within when you get to an issue like this. But that's why you haven't heard from directly. But Jim and I have talked. The conversation between us doesn't violate the open meeting law. And we have come to you with a suggested motion, which would be at this point that in the criteria for next year's allocation, that we recommend that the Indian self-governing harvest regulation not be considered when assessing programs requesting outdoor heritage funds in the next call. We have done projects on land covered by tribal rights before. There's a map in here that shows that. The difference with this was where the ownership was performed. And that's the only difference. So with that as background, I throw open to you for discussion on this matter.
I have a problem with the technicality of it. I don't have any trouble with the intent, but I think that our council has to abide by all of the laws all of the time, and singling out this issue to write, you know, to make it raise to the level of having a criteria, I think would make the whole process subject to adding. Let's add another criteria. Let's add another criteria. That is not to say that I disagree with the intent of the motion and this issue and the importance of the issue, but I don't think that this issue is any more important than any other law that falls outside of our little tiny world of our criteria. So to formalize it is my problem. I think it opens up floodgates for making exceptions to exceptions to exceptions, and I think it'll ball up the whole works.
Our intent was not, and I understand what you're saying, our intent was not to ball things up, but to clarify what had been kind of an unknown.
But isn't it a move, I mean, isn't it redundant? Isn't it redundant in the fact that we have to abide by all laws and statutes and treaties, et cetera?
In that it is.
I don't like redundant bureaucracy. Yeah. That's what I don't like.
The question would be how do we respond appropriately to say we won't do what we did?
And I think we have a healthy discussion about it and get it on the record.
That's all this was intended to do. Scott?
One point, Mr. Chair, that I would absolutely like to clarify, a little point of disagreement, maybe. You know, I understand the issues that were discussed when the project was brought forth as an amendment to our appropriation. But I can tell you that I believe that myself and all members, when we scored those projects initially, when we read through those proposals, when we then made allocations, we absolutely did use all of the criteria in making those decisions, okay? It fell below the line, okay, long before any other such discussions took place, okay? So to say that I or any other member did not use the criteria, we just did not discuss any other criteria at that point. But I certainly used all of the criteria, you know, where it's at. You know, I balanced protection in the northern forest zone against protection in the prairie zone, and I did all of those other things. So I will be on record as saying I certainly used all the criteria when I scored that project prior to that meeting.
And I think that's very fair. I think I was referring to the discussion that took place at the meeting alone and not the scoring process. Kenny?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, for dealing with the difficult situation that I probably was partly responsible because I didn't understand past practice. I have one question for the executive director, and then I think I want to make a motion. Mr. Becker, do we have any money on the bottom line? I know you don't know what the forecast is going to be. I think we all have an inclination of what might happen from the forecast. But what is on the bottom line today? And this request is how big?
Mr. Chair, the request is $2 million and change. We'll get the exact number in a second. We have allocated all $92 million that's forecast to be collected in the February forecast. Any additional money on the bottom line would be money that's turned back, and I know of $300,000 that's going to be turned back by Dakota County. And any excess or any additional monies that come in as a result of forecasted higher collections. We can't for sure tell whether they're going to be forecasted higher collections because we're not sure how the February forecast addressed the fiscal cliff and whether the November forecast will address the slight recession that's due to occur if we go off the fiscal cliff.
Mr. Chair, the dollar request is $2,476,000.
And just to clarify, even beyond that, there were really two requests in this. One was for the Simi Lake property, and the other was for some downstream properties in addition to that. The Simi Lake is the property that I talked about looking at, which is $1.75 million on an estimated basis, and I don't believe an appraisal has been done.
And on a slightly different note, something that I have to bring up to the council, I've just been informed by council, SEL, that the 1855 treaty area should not be on this map, that it should only be the blue and the magenta. Right?
Mr. Chair and Bill, the 1854 and 1837 treaties are, you know, have been litigated to show that the because there was a sentence in each of the treaties that said that that the Indians would have the right to hunt and fish on those properties throughout the treaty area after the treaty was signed. 1855 did not have that same sentence within the treaty. In fact, this is the area that's been of some controversy in recent years because of a professor at William Mitchell who somehow thinks that this is the same as the other ones. And you've seen a few band members that have tried to assert their rights in this area, but they have not been litigated. The sentence does not exist within those treaties, and it is not the same kind of an area at all. So it really shouldn't be considered in the same levels, 1854 and 1837.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that that if there's additional money in the next forecast, I think our next meeting is after the forecast, I'd like to make a motion and open it for discussion that $1.7 million of the next money, should it be available, be allocated to this Fond du Lac project. And I think the reality that would send a message of where we're coming from. There's been a lot of work on both sides of the Native American issue for a number of years, and we've actually made really good progress. This was a really bad divide for a long time, and I don't think it's fair that we not include them. The courts have ruled that agreements are what the agreements are, and no matter where you are on that side of the issue, we should respect where it's been. And we've historically fought and done these deals in this area, and I don't think we should cut them short. I don't think that's the right message. I wish I would have been more informed at our last meeting, but I think that I really like the project. I mean, and I'm talking about the 1.7. I didn't really get into the other one, but I think this is a really cool project. And I believe there's going to be some money left. I'm hopeful, though I probably won't be here, I'm hopeful that we don't spend the additional money. I hope that we only spend this money, and I got a feeling there's going to be a little extra, that we keep something on the bottom line. But I think this project was one of the better projects. So I'd like to make a motion that, assuming we have money, that this group would go on record as supporting that.
So just to clarify, your motion is that if the November forecast received in December has extra money up to the extent it has $1.7 million, that amount would be allocated to this project.
Right. And I guess just a housekeeping question. We've talked about it not having an appraisal, and we had a big discussion last time about a project without an appraisal. I believe this only raises to the level of one certified appraisal, but it certainly would be conditioned like all projects that it be required to have an appraisal. I think $3 million is the break point to get two certified appraisals, if I remember right. So this would have one, and whatever the standard is, I would assume that would apply, so we don't have that controversy, and that could happen.
Is that right? The $3 million is the break point? I don't think it really matters to the discussion, but
there's got to be one. Whatever the rules are. I just would want it to be on. That's assumed it has to be on land. We buy land without appraisal.
It follows procedures.
Thank you.
Jane?
Well, if you'd only listened to me last time. Anyway, no, that's it. You know.
You're not the first one that's accused me of
that. I just think the timing was wrong. I am sympathetic with the intent, but I think we should do things in an orderly fashion, and once the money's there, I think that's the time for the discussion, because there could be other issues that arise between now and then. So I'm being technical this morning, I guess.
I guess so,
Ron. Mr. Chair, I also think we'll getting way ahead of ourselves here, because the issue for me was never the treaty hunting and fishing rights. The issue has been buying Indian trust land for the tribe. Indian trust land, I'm no lawyer, but checked it out, is a whole different animal. And to prove my point, the chairman of the Fond du Lac band announced that all of its tribal lands would be closed to wolf hunting this year. And if we bought this land, it would be closed to wolf hunting. And I don't think the people in Minnesota who are using their sales tax would agree that land that we would buy would not be open to all legal hunting seasons set by our Department of Natural Resources. I think we need some better input here on tribal trust land. I have no problem with this project. And I would suggest perhaps that the band and another organization, maybe DNR, would get together and we will protect this land, but it would not be tribal trust land. We would not be buying land for a specific group of people.
I think that we're trying to speak for the tribe now, and I don't think we can do that either. I think that they're very capable of speaking for themselves, and I think we should let them speak for themselves as to what their intent is.
Would you like to come down and speak for yourself? Thank you for coming today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So if you both, for the record, because we're taping this, identify yourselves and maybe even answer Ron's concern or start with the discussion on Ron's concern.
Sure. I'm Karen Diver. I'm the chairwoman of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa.
I'm Thomas Hollis, I'm the Natural Resources Program Manager for the band.
So specifically, you wanted to know what? Can you rephrase the question for me, please?
Ron?
My concern was, I thought the council, I personally had no problem with the treaty hunting rights. What I have an issue with is the council buying Indian Trust land, because that also is not within our criteria. And if we did, that tribal trust land is a whole different category in the history between the United States and tribal bands. And as an example, I think you announced there would be no wolf hunting on your tribal lands. If we had bought that land and was supposed to be open to hunting for non-tribal and tribal people, if we bought that and it became tribal trust land, would wolf hunting be allowed there? That was my question.
As it stands right now, tribal trust land is actually land that's held by the federal government on behalf of the Fond du Lac Band. It's a part of the trust responsibility of the federal government. Regarding the, and our right to self-govern and set our regulations for hunting, fishing, and gathering were established by treaty. And that's been successfully implemented over the last 25 to 30 years with not much controversy. It's called co-management. And that generally happens in discussion and cooperation and negotiation with the DNR. That really didn't occur around the wolf hunt in particular. I think if we had followed the timeline for the five-year moratorium after the delisting, it might have had some time for that to occur. I know of no other species that we're talking about where something like this would be this disagreeable, because generally most species are meant to be taken. The wolf hunt discussion really didn't happen. We've been in conversation with the governor regarding somewhat the disagreements about the quickness of the wolf hunt and how to manage that population on an ongoing basis. He's committed to not only Fond du Lac, but the rest of the tribes that conversation will occur over the next year. Wisconsin did honor the request of its tribe so that the state actually cooperated with tribes to close reservation borders for the Anishinaabe people in particular to not have wolf hunting within their borders. We know it's a highly migratory species. The amount of land that is impacted is negligible in the overall hunting area that's available. And it was a good compromise in order to respect the cultural traditions of tribal people and still accomplish, state hunting for those people who wish to do it. The wolf is particularly different than any other species in terms of our relationship to it and our cultural traditions. We don't have that same strong feeling about other species. It's merely the wolf. But a part of it is just an overall wolf management protocol and implementing our co-management responsibilities with the state. So we're hoping that we will take the wolf hunt over the course of the next year and have those discussions in the same way we do about every other species that we hunt, fish, and gather. This one was just different, I think, because of timing. So I have great hopes that we'll be able to come to a place where the state and the tribes are co-managing this in a way that is respectful to both sides of the issue.
Okay. Jane?
Oh, Scott? If that conversation went the way you wanted it to, would those tribal lands be close to wolf hunters?
I can't tell you that. Right now, because we don't even have our own wolf management plan, we thought we'd be working over the course of 5 years in cooperation with the DNR and our other partners. I can't tell you that. I can tell you that it's even a struggle within our own community to come to a decision about that. We haven't even had those conversations yet. There are some members of our own community who would like to have a wolf hunt. And right now we've told them they can do so through the state process, but not with a tribal license. So I can't answer that. I do know that if you took it strictly on a cultural basis, it would probably be the preference that happen outside of our borders. The wolf is considered our brother, and it is highly tied to what we feel the health of the Anishinaabe people are. If the wolf is not healthy, that it's a reflection on the status of the people. And I think respecting cultural traditions of the bands shouldn't be something that is such a bar that we set that we think it's unattainable. Tom here has several analogies around relationship of people's cultural traditions to animals. You know, he used the cow as an example. From far away, and that's respected and incorporated into broader society. We can do that here without much controversy, but it actually is a foundation of respect, much like the tribes have brought to the table around its other hunting, fishing, and gathering, where we've tried to make a balance between our needs and the needs of, the broader population and their wishes to hunt, fish, and gather. And that's gone great here since we've been negotiating the treaty rights and those were established in court. And I have no doubt this will happen too. I don't think it's much to ask that our cultural traditions be respected. At the same time, we're not asserting any. This is probably a key point, and you're really honing in on the 100,000 acres of Fond du Lac and some of the other tribal communities. Fairly negligible in the overall amount of acreage that gets to be hunted. We have not asserted anything in the ceded territories. We would have that right under our treaties to actually say we want to actually impact the overall taking of this animal within our whole ceded territory area. We have not done that, nor are we going to choose to do that. We're only asking that our borders be respected. And I think that's key because, the other species, we look at what is the harvest that will take in the whole area, and we negotiate it, and we're not saying you shouldn't do it or that you should reduce your numbers. We're just saying respect our borders. You don't like to see your brother getting killed next door. We don't own all of the land within our borders. It's probably not ever going to happen. So drive a couple miles and go hunt outside of our borders.
Wayne, did you have a...
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just was, when we were talking about the letter that came out and everything else, note that they had mentioned, the plan had mentioned these 10 criteria that we were supposed to look at, and basically that was it. I want to remind everybody that, you know, we had a number of requesters that met that same 10 criteria, and some of them never got a hearing at all. They were none of them. There's some that didn't get 7 votes, and yet they still met the same criteria. And we've been doing this now for 5 rounds. And every year that we look at some don't get a hearing for particular reasons, even though they meet the same 10 criteria. So the question, even that we didn't look at this thing openly, I think is wrong. Plus the fact that there's still questions such as tax liability, property tax. We've gone through property tax liability every year since day one on these things. Who's responsible for property tax liability? And it has become an issue to the point where we ask that same question on almost every project which has passed. And we didn't get to that point, but asking who bears the tax, the property tax liability on this particular property if it's purchased by bank. Yes.
Sure. When land is turned into federal Indian trust land, the counties and affected jurisdictions do receive impact days from the federal government. It's not a dollar-for-dollar replacement, largely because a lot of it is rural. You know, it doesn't need necessarily the infrastructure you would in a municipality. In addition, as a jurisdiction that has, we have 2 counties, about 9 townships, and 2 cities within our borders. We participate voluntarily and helped with the creation of the Cloquet Area Fire District, where we fund that so we can increase fire services and capabilities, so we're not relying only on a volunteer fire department. We have our own police force. There hasn't been a during our flooding, actually, because of the band, every single road that was within our borders, whether we owned it or not, was eligible for Bureau of Indian Affairs road money. So there will be no state money or local match having to be used in that. So it isn't always the same pocketbook as property tax. But the band brings to the table a wealth of other resources because of not only our own capabilities, but the unique stream of funding we bring to it from sources that are unique to tribal governments.
Ryan?
Mr. Chair, what is our requirement again for keeping land open to hunting as a council when we approve the purchase of land?
It is open to hunting unless prohibited by law, is the language.
Prohibited by DNR.
Well, Greg or Janelle?
Mr. Chair, the Constitution reads it has to be open to the public taking a fishing game during the open season unless otherwise provided by law. Last year, you put in some statutory provisions that provide a framework for that unless otherwise provided by law. One is, as part of the accomplishment plan, they're supposed to have a hunting and fishing management plan that includes if there's any closures for any species during any part of the season have to be included in that accomplishment plan. And then you also, for lands that are not fish and wildlife lands and that are not state lands, you say that the Commissioner of Natural Resources must approve any restrictions on hunting and fishing on those lands. So there are some conditions that if you were to purchase or to provide money for the band to purchase lands, that would any restrictions on hunting and fishing would have to be in that accomplishment plan. And then they would also have to be signed off on by the Commissioner of Natural Resources.
Okay. So, you know, on a practical matter, if we were to allocate money and the band said, I can't live with this, they could decide not to take it. But if there's a process in place that would require, if they don't want to follow everything, that they have to put it in the accomplishment plan and it has to be approved by the commission.
So it would be my understanding if we purchase this land for the Indian Trust category, and DNR decides to have another wolf season up there. But the band decides that its trust land would be closed to wolf hunting. The DNR commissioner could not approve that closure, and it would remain open to whoever wanted to hunt wolves on that land that we're buying. That's my point.
I think that's the logical legal conclusion. Greg or Janelle, do you have a different?
Well, Mr. Chair, the one issue here is the band is not subject to state law, basically, on regulations. But as a part of the contractual obligation, when DNR and the band sign a contract, all the money goes through as a contract, they would be signing a contractual obligation for that. They're not necessarily subject to state law on certain civil restrictions or whatever of these property, things like that. But there is, I think through the contractual obligation, once they sign the contract, they would be signing on to whatever those restrictions are.
Okay. Les?
Ms. Diver? First of all, to lighten it up a little bit, the pronunciation of the native name for that lake, Shai Wezo Zegro Egini. Could you pronounce that?
No, I can't. Okay. He may be able to.
It's Chuazo Zegaikini.
All right.
It's a name of an old man that used to live there a long time ago. So that's why it's named. Zegaikini is lake.
Thank you. I do agree with Scott and Wayne on when we go through these processes, we look at things that don't necessarily come up for discussion. Two of the things that struck me is the urgency of the project. I know there was a notation here that it was available through a realtor at a certain price. How soon does that land move? That's looking in the future with kind of an unknown whether it will ever move. The price of the property was a concern. I recently purchased property in St. Louis County for about 10% of the value listed there. So I don't know, is this a real, and we have to look at the appraisal process. The thing that I think kind of stuck in my mind is I had the opportunity to visit with the county commissioners in the Northeast. Tom was at the meeting, and frankly, they were very, very irate as far as the removal of the lands from the tax base. And we had a very, very open, frank discussion up there about 3 years ago. And about, I think it's around 85% of the lands in St. Louis County are owned by some government agency. I think in the county to the northeast of there, it's almost 92%. Now, I haven't had a chance to talk with any of these county commissioners, Frank Jewell or Mike Florentman, as far as the attitude as to what happens when these lands go off the tax rolls and what is the compensation in lieu and how much is this going to supplement to a normal PILT or property tax level. It's always a concern for them, and you well know that the small territories, the small townships, man, are under a lot of financial duress, and there has to be a cooperative effect. And the county commissioners that I've seen up there aren't very happy as far as the public ownership or the county, the state or the federal government ownership of the land. As we've experienced with the federal government, they're not always good at paying the bills as far as
you don't have to tell us that.
And it's the PILT liability on this property, I think, is pretty defined and it's a pretty standard formula. So those are my concerns. And the sovereign immunity of the band is a concern. You know, when the constitutional amendment was passed in the state of Minnesota, the tribe has no liability to the statute of the Constitution or the statutory law. Is that correct? The tribe is not under the Constitution or the statutory law of Minnesota. I'm asking that question, Greg.
Mr. Chair, Les, that's a little broad. Let's just say that they are not subject to state regulatory laws. they're not necessarily subject to state regulatory laws. There are criminal laws, and that gets very complicated. But generally, and as we know, especially in this area, they're not subject to the state hunting and fishing laws. You know, throughout the secret territory, they're subject to their own requirements.
I did read through the example on the sales tax law, and believe me, 297A does need revision. That is a very complicated, extremely difficult tax law to try to interpret in sales tax. How that applies, I understand some of the sales tax that are paid by the tribe are then refunded by the state government, and there's an ongoing relationship. I tried to read that and try to make some sense of that. Maybe you could make some sense to that.
Who can make sense of tax law? I would like to address a couple of your points quickly, and I guess I want to also say thank you. I know we've been given time to work through some of this with all of you just because it is unusual, and we appreciate that. You know, we'll see where it goes, but I very much respect the fact that some of the questions that you normally don't have to deal with these requests is having time to get answered. Number one, regarding, the counties and, the status of Indian land within their borders, you really have to recall that we existed before there was counties, cities, and a state. So they feel some right to have, maintain a tax base within our borders, where we would look at it just a little differently. We look at it, you had a good 150-year run of taxing Indian land that never should have been on your books anyway. Reclaiming land within a border is actually a real priority for every single tribe across the country, and there have been, even within the St. Louis County Commission, you would probably have varying degrees of thought. I know there was one commissioner in particular that really didn't like it. Like I said, in addition to impact aid, we give money to the St. Louis County Sheriff's Department. Even though we have our own police department and we don't often see their sheriff's department within our borders. Fond du Lac is the second largest employer in all of northeastern Minnesota. We have 2,200 employees. We pump $110 million into the regional economy, rural Minnesota, every single year. We are a huge economic driver of what's going on in northeastern Minnesota. So to say that you want it in this little pocketbook here, and this little pocketbook here, and this little pocketbook here, I think is really unfair, because you need to look at the band holistically. A lot of people are paying for all kinds of stuff because the band is there. A lot of other people are keeping their jobs and paying for their health care and shopping and paying local sales tax because we're there. So it isn't necessarily always in the stream that you want it, but our presence there, we're surpassed only by the Essentia Health System as the largest employer. So I don't think it's fair to say, we have one parcel we were arguing about with the county, it was like $1,200. Well, our payroll is $1.2 million a week. That's a lot of money being pumped into rural Minnesota. So, that we're some kind of economic drain on the region is an argument that I'm just not going to support in any way, shape, or form, because with that many employees, with Cloquet having about 10,000 people in our county, you're counting them in tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands. We're an important economic driver and contribute to a lot of their stability.
Unless I would just clarify one thing in terms of subject to laws. The contract between, not the council, but the council and the tribe for this property would be subject to the laws of the state. So, that's not, there are plenty of confusions about this, but the fact that they would enter into a grant agreement and have to live to the provisions of that grant agreement is not a questionable item.
Mr. Chair, just one comment. Would the state then be under, say, the governance of the federal government? And would the federal government trump any contract that the state makes?
Janelle, or I don't think that the state that the feds can negate a contract between
the state and someone else just because they're the feds. I mean, that would be a huge problem for all of us if they could do that.
Mr. Chairman, I think you stated it accurately.
What was that?
I said, Mr. Chairman, I think you stated it accurately. I think once you have a contractual arrangement, I don't think even the feds can come in and change that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are talking, the subject here is preventing forest fragmentation. Of course, that's something that only north central and northeastern Minnesota has to deal with. As Les said, we have a lot of, and the chair, we have a lot of government and trust land in northeastern Minnesota. That isn't necessarily bad, but we do a different, we manage it a different way than you do in western Minnesota or southwestern Minnesota. We need to compromise, we need to work together, and we do. Whether it's the bands, whether it's the DNR, whether it's the federal government, whether it's the counties, we all have to work together to manage our lands and our wildlife. And, you know, I just think that, again, back to preventing forest fragmentation, which really doesn't have to be done anyplace else in Minnesota, that this is a good project. And there's numerous opportunities in north central and northeastern Minnesota to do this type of thing. And it's the managing of our lands. You know, in this particular case, I don't think it has a heck of a lot to do with the tax liability. I think it's mostly how we're going to manage effectively an area that we have. And that, in fact, is a big piece of the economy. Because if we fragment our land up there, we can't manage it for our economic well-being. And that covers not only tourism, but forestry and all those particular things. So, I guess I don't think we ought to be. I think that it's been exemplary the cooperation between all the different bodies up there, and I think they've done a great job at this particular point, and I really think that we ought to give some consideration to another way that we're going to manage effectively northeastern, north central Minnesota that we don't have to do in any other part of the state.
So, Mr. Chair, this has been a very educational process, if nothing else. Trying to get to the bottom of it, I mean, in the beginning, trying to figure out whether this even a project we should be looking at and whatever. So, we're at a point now where, to me, I'm going to personally decide to follow in the process we've used in the past just out of respect for the process that we do have. And that is that we have people that have not had an opportunity. There's groups that have requested funding, which we're not given a hearing. We have groups that we cut their funding, and they are not here today to bring it back to the table and ask for full funding of their projects. And so as much as I appreciate the fact that it appears to be a good project and something maybe we should have funded, we didn't. And so I want to move forward and say that I would object to the voting on that or approving that motion this year, asking to come back with the project next year, and unless we are prepared to let all participants and all requesters come back and have the same right.
Any other? We do have a motion on the floor made by Denny, which is to subject to the forecast showing there's more money than what we have now, up to the $1.7 million, to add that to the allocation recommendation. So, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No. No.
Can I see a show of hands? All those in favor? Opposed? No, it's happened. All right. So I'll get back to what Jim and I had talked about, which was a motion regarding the criteria. To be explicit in our future calls for requests that Indian lands would be considered on an open basis. Jim, do you want to say anything?
I don't think I have a lot to add, but I think it would be good for us, because this is a special relationship that we would have to have with these properties, to put that criteria in place, just so everyone understands in the future that at least that part of the ability to hunt and fish the land, that's a decision that's been made and should not influence decisions on tribal properties.
So will you make that motion?
I'll make that motion.
Any discussion on the motion? All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Show of hands, all those in favor. 2, 3, 4. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All right, motion fails. So I'd like to put it to the council. How do we communicate appropriately to the tribes that they can be an equal partner in our process?
Put it in the call.
That's what this was.
And not as a criteria.
Okay. How would you put it in the call? I'm asking.
Do we have an example of this year's round in the call for requests? Because there's a lot more in there than the criteria.
We do not have copies of the call.
Well, I guess I'm just saying that it shouldn't be a criteria. The criteria is a criteria, but it could be mentioned as supporting information in the call. Like a lot of other stuff is.
Mr. Chair, Councilor Kingston, idea would be brought about by deleting in the motion that's on your agenda item memo the words criteria stating and substituting include the state.
I'm good with that.
Okay. Brian?
Mr. Chairman, I think what we need here, as I said, the treaty rights are not the argument here. They have treaty rights to hunt and fish without regulation. Nobody's arguing that. The issue to me is, does the council have the wherewithal to expand Indian trust land? I don't see that anywhere in what our duties are. I would suggest that let's get an attorney general's opinion. Is the council within its power to buy and give to tribes land that will forever be under their jurisdiction? If our attorney general says that's within the realm of our duty, I'm all for it, because for what they said about their culture, etc., Chairwoman Dyra, I have no argument with any of that. But I think we're on a slippery slope here. Our expertise is preserving areas of natural resources. And I have no problem preserving that beautiful piece of land that you saw. But that's not what's before us here. What's before us is, do we buy and expand Indian trust land? And I don't have the answer to that. And I don't know anybody here that does. So I think before we do anything, let's get some opinion from the highest office of legal opinion in this state.
Janelle, Greg, do you have thoughts?
Mr.
Chair, members, I guess my initial thought is you guys are making recommendations, and at the end of the day, the state is the one that's going to be making the decision whether or not to enter into, and I would assume, and I believe we've done this with other state funds, maybe not necessarily outdoor heritage funds, but we have purchased land as a state when it's in, you know, the state's best interest. I don't think it's a legal argument.
I was just going to say the same thing. I'm not an attorney, and I don't hope or pretend to be, but the issue of the whole legality of it, it's not our job to worry about. And should we worry about it? Yeah. I mean, it's not on paper that we should worry about it, but it's not our determination to make. And I don't think it should be overbearing pressure on us. I think we should keep our focus on what our job is, and that's picking out good conservation projects and how they compete with the other slate that year. I think the process is a good one. I think these questions are all legitimate, but they're not ours to solve. I think we're taking on, biting off more than is our responsibility to solve. And, you know, we're not paying for it. The state is paying for it. The legislators are going to pay for it. Should we present them with a package that's sound? Yeah. But without some kind of other information, I think we should ignore it.
Scott?
In the words of one of our initial members, Bob Schroeder, at the end of almost every testimony and every discussion we had, he goes, you know, does this meet the constitutional mandate? You guys ask that over and over and over and over. And I concur with Rod that you're right. It isn't, the bottom line is not, it isn't our responsibility to know everything. But it is our responsibility to do our very best to uphold and follow the Constitution. So Ron's question is, does this meet the requirements of the constitutional amendment? I think that question's very sound, and I think we should find somebody to give us a formal decision on that so that we know how to go.
Well, you know, I asked that question 2 months ago off the record, and I was told that until it's an issue, it's not an issue.
Is that request within? Can we make that request, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, we could find a counsel to give us an opinion. I'm not sure that it's the Attorney General that's appropriate to provide the opinion in this particular case.
Well,
would
it
be the House or Senate counsel?
But just to clarify, the state has, in the past, provided money to the tribes to purchase land that becomes trust property held by the federal government for benefit of the tribe. Is that what you were saying today?
Is that what this is?
No.
Yep. Mr. Chair, the state has, I mean, I especially remember some of the reparations that were made in the past. There were also some lands that were given to the tribes because of some problems in the past and that sort of thing. And that is now trust land. I mean, I think the issue is what Scott's trying to bring up is you've got a specific constitutional provision on what this money is to be spent for. And I think they're asking is whether or not it fits within that criteria of the constitutional provision. And I think, you know, if you look at the constitutional provision, it's basically you're providing habitat for the benefit of Minnesotans. I think if this meets the criteria of providing habitat for the benefit of Minnesotans, it should fit within that constitutional provision.
So, from an opinion standpoint, who would verify or conflict with that, with your reading of it? I'm asking the question because
Mr. Chair, I don't know if anybody ever meant my two cents, but it's I think, I mean, if it's for the benefit of Minnesotans, I mean, we're spending money in Iowa on protection for, you know, invasive species. If it's to the benefit of Minnesotans and it's providing habitat, it seems like it fits in my mind within the Constitution.
I saw Janelle nodding her head as well, but Heather?
I just want to point out, too, that one of the other constitutional funds has purchased acquired traditional cultural property that was conveyed to the Leech Lake Band last year.
Okay. So, I think Denny? No, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, Mr. Chair, I think as far as constitutional, I'm not a lawyer, but this is okay to buy constitutionally. I mean, we buy stuff with restrictions all the time on it. We're buying stuff in the metro that's not as open to public hunting as stuff in the rural area, but it does have to meet the Constitution, and this land does have the local body. As far as the wolf hunting, I think it's important. It was the legislature that pushed that issue forward on a fast track. We were hopeful that DNR and the Native American tribes would all be able to come together and work out an agreement on what would be on it. We would be consistent with the Native American tribes. But because we put it on such a fast track, in that the legislature wanted to hunt the season we're in right now, and continue to be in the first season. Unfortunately, as the chairwoman said herself, there was a lot of discussion within the different tribes. They weren't able to come to a plan. I think, Ron, long term, that will happen. We're not going to always be happy both sides of the issue. Take the Mille Lacs fishing. We're not going to be happy, some of us, on one side or the other. But normally, I think they'll get worked out to what the situation is. We have to work within the requirements of the law and what the courts have said. We have to be careful that we're going to pick winners and losers based on different criteria. We should be, as everybody has said here, just evaluating a project on its own and looking at it. And sometimes if that means we buy land and the band ends up owning. I mean, we did just buy $11 million worth that the county ended up owning. I mean, that was a good deal. It's a great piece of land. You know, the county owns it. We gave it to the county. And if I'm not mistaken, the county board tomorrow could pass a resolution that you can't hunt on the land. Subject to law, you can't hunt it. I don't know how that would all work, and we'd end up in lawyer fights at that point. But different people, the only hunting they allow in Dakota County in Invergrove Heights is bull hunting for deer and turkey, and we bought that land. It's a great, awesome project, awesome piece of land, and really cool. And there's going to be kids and maybe some disabled punks and stuff on that land. I think this is an advisory group, and that's what we're supposed to be. And Gene, I think you said it very well. That's what we're supposed to do, and look at it in the big picture. Should we, in the back of our mind, be thinking about, you know, this kind of stinks that they're not going to hunt timberwolves on this land this year, or they wouldn't have if it was this year. You know, I mean, we should think that out, and if it's in our mind, that's why we say, no, I think that's okay. But I think we want to be careful that we just say, well, just because the tribe's going to own it. I mean, all of us haven't necessarily liked who ends up owning the land. Myself, I'd rather have the state own all the land or buy it with sales tax.
Oh, my God.
From a practical... No, that we buy with just dedicated sales tax. It's the state dedicated sales tax. I think you could argue legitimately the state should own the land, not giving it to different groups, whether it's the Native Americans, Crowing County, or whoever. But sometimes it makes sense to do it that way. And I think we have to be, you know, enough said. But I hope that this project will be worked through the way and find it out, because this whole Native American thing, we have some big issues, and I don't want to get on the wrong side of the Mille Lacs and the walleye count. And we have to work with these folks, and they have developed a lot of professionals that are oppressive in natural resources. And that's what this discussion should be about, the natural resources. I appreciate the tribe. I got one 10 miles from my home that's doing a great job, and they're big employers and all that. Well, actually, when I'm here this morning, that's what I care about. I'm here. I want to do the best we can on the land. And I was under the mistake that we were going down a precedent that was new and different. And in the haste, I just hope, well, long term, this is a cool project. If it's not this year, maybe someday in the future.
So, Jane, do you want to make a motion that changes that Bill suggested from criteria to statement?
Strike criteria and change ING to EMENT. Motion to include a statement that Indian self-governing, etc.
you're making that motion.
So moved, yes.
So for people who aren't following, there is in your packet an agenda item memo with a suggested motion on it. The suggested motion is being amended itself to strike criteria stating and to insert the word state.
Okay. Any discussion?
I'm sorry, Phil. We'll buy that one more time.
In your packet is an agenda item memo. On this agenda item, there's a suggested motion. Mm-hmm. The suggested motion is printed, reads motion to include a criteria stating that Indian self governing harvest regulation shall not be considered. And in that motion, change the word criteria stating to statement. So it reads a motion to include a statement that Indian self governing regulation shall not be considered.
Okay. Everyone clear?
No. I just got to. Could you go through it just one more time?
Sure. Let me read the amended motion. Have you got it in front of me, Scott?
Yes.
Oh, good. Motion to include a statement that Indian self-governing harvest regulation. You got it, Alex?
Yeah.
All in favor of the motion?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Any other discussion on this topic? Any other thoughts or? All right. Thank you for coming down and speaking with us today. Members, next on the agenda is a discussion of the work is a discussion of the DNR direct support for instance calculation. Tom Landwehr is here to hit you on this.
It's on you, huh?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Council, Tom Landwehr, Future Department of Resources and Health. Mr. Chairman, I must admit for the last 2 days I've been in a duck blind sitting there thinking how am I going to bring complex divisive issues that pulled up the city council. It's totally dark in their day, and I realize now that, you know what, I might be breaking up your day. So I appreciate being second on the agenda rather than first. But Mr. Chairman, members, I am here today to ask for some discussion and a decision slash recommendation on a topic that we've been talking about for quite a while. And that is something that we're calling direct and necessary expenses. You do have a handout in your packet, but I'm asking for another one to be distributed that has some additional information on that. And Mr. Chairman, I would like to start out just as an introduction by talking about what it is we're here asking today. Those of you who are in business understand that when you hire an employee, when you make a product or you sell a service, there are direct expenses that are very identifiable. You pay for an employee, you pay for equipment, you pay for supplies. What is less identifiable are the backroom expenses like the accountant and the lawyer and the computer specialist, all of which need to provide support for that person or that project. And, Mr. Chairman, that's really what we're here today to talk about, is that in the tradition of project development for both LSOHC proposals and LCOHI proposals, typically there has been a willingness or an inability to pull out those indirect expenses that are still necessary for a project and include them in the project reimbursements. The challenge with that, for all of us, it's the NGOs as well as the government agencies, is that we have real expenses that accrue to these projects that we are not getting reimbursements for from the dedicated funds. And I understand that there's a philosophy that, well, everybody should contribute in some skin in the game in these projects, and I understand that, and I don't disrespect that. What the bind is that we get into, we as a department, is that we don't have any sort of discretionary pots of money from which to pay for these funds. Right now, the department is primarily funded by other dedicated funds, county fishing license fees, gas tax fees, ATV fees, all of these fees that have a dedicated purpose. So when we have these other expenses that aren't paid for by the Outdoor Heritage Fund, we have been dipping into those pots, whether it be the diminishing amount of general fund we've got or one of these other sources. And council members, I think we've got a real constitutional issue as well as a financial issue. The constitutional issue is the Constitution says we shall not supplant, we shall supplement. And we are currently supplanting with these dedicated funds the expenses of the Outdoor Heritage Fund project. And further, as our general fund allotment to the department diminishes, we went from 48% of our department was general funded in fiscal year 2000 to 18% last year. Our discretionary money, if you will, is going away as well. It makes it more and more challenging for us to take on projects that have especially high personnel costs, because that's what most of our indirect expenses are accrued. But we really are at the point where the projects are getting more and more challenging to do because of our inability to use funds for picking up some of these other expenses. So, members of the council, this is not a new issue. We've been talking about this for a while. We've had a number of discussions with here at the LCCMR. We've had discussions with the legislative auditor, a lot of internal discussions about what is the right way to proceed with this, and developed a process that looks at the different types of costs. And if you look at that page one, we talk about cost types. When we look at expenses in the DNR, we're putting them into four buckets. They're the direct project costs. And you all understand what these are. This is the cost for a biologist to go out and do a prescribed fire. This is the cost for a piece of equipment that's used to plant grass. Those are very obvious ones, but those are traditionally what we've been able to fund. Another cost is the commissioner's office, and that's not just me. That's a number of commissioners and the expense for running the department. Nobody's ever presuming to cover those costs. My time here today is not, we're not trying to cover my time being here today. As modest as it might be, I must assist Mr. Consultant, but those costs are things we set off to the side. But there are two other categories of costs that we believe are relevant to the projects, and that we would like to request consideration for reimbursement. One of those is what we call department direct support services. And so you can see listed on the page what those are. These are essentially, and on the back, I might direct you as well. On the back is a table that shows, on page two, a table that shows department direct support services. We lump these under professional business services, but this is the computer technician that has to set up the computer, make sure that the email is running, make sure they do bug checking. It is the HR person that has to get that new employee signed up, get their pay timesheets approved and coded and routed. All of these are fairly modest expenses in and of themselves. They don't lend themselves to direct accounting for, like a piece of equipment or like an hour of an employee's salary. And the fourth type is what we call division direct services. And again, if you look at the back of that page, it lists some of the other expenses that are associated with it. So all of our employees work in one of four regions. There are regional costs. When they buy a piece of equipment, for instance, they send an invoice into the region. The region codes it, allocates it to the right funding source, and then sends it into St. Paul. So we have support costs in the region in addition to the support costs at the department. So those are the four cost categories that we look at. And I want to again reflect that the commissioner's office is one that we take out. These other three truly do have a role in the direct application of projects on the ground. But they're very difficult to account for. We don't, you know, if somebody approves a timesheet, it might be a 30-second deal, it might be a one-minute deal. If there's a problem, maybe it's a five-minute deal. But our HR people don't go on Costco and say, well, Tom Landry's timesheet is all screwed up, so therefore we have to go to this pot of money to pay for that. They just code to our HR billing services. And so, but we can use the same approach the business uses when we look at how to compensate for these costs. And that, in the business world, is called full cost accounting. When you sell a widget or you sell a service, you look at all of the costs that are accumulated around that widget or that service, and you divide that up to each widget or each hour of service that you provide. And that's what we have done, and that's what we have run by the Office of Legislative Auditor, who has looked at it and said, this is the right approach. So on the bottom of page one, it talks about the methodology for that process. And, Mr. Chair, I'll offer, this is extremely complex. Anybody knows auditing or accounting knows that you can't get into the too far into the weeds without glossing people's eyes over something. Offer to not do that at the moment, but assert that the process that we use looks specifically at each type of project and each one of our divisions to devise a rate for each project. Now, the way that we apply those costs is comparable. So if we have an hour of employee time, we assume that that hour of employee time takes an equal amount of IT, information technology services, and we apply that equally. But projects are different, and let me give you a really good example. If we were to do the Northwoods project, an $11 million acquisition, direct acquisition, there is relatively little personnel costs associated with that. We'd have a negotiator, you'd have the appraisal, you'd have some other surveying work and so on around that. But of the $11 million, it might be $200,000 in the umbrella. The personnel costs around that are very modest. The capital expenses around that eat up the majority of the cost. So the indirect expenses on that are very minimal. If, on the other hand, you're paying for a burn crew that has to go out and it's a high salary, it's a project that has a high salary component, well, each one of those people needs, you know, all kinds of backroom support, pay the bills, pay for their time, get that equipment to make sure that they've got the liability insurance and all of the other things. So it becomes very, very expensive. And when I say very expensive, I'm still talking about single-digit types of expenses, percentage expenses. But it is much different than an acquisition. If all we did was acquisition, we would have almost no indirect expenses because there's such a modest amount in a capital-intensive project like that. So on the back of page two, it talks about some of the calculations that we use for devising what this direct and necessary expense is. And when we use that term direct and necessary, that's what the appropriation language last time provided for as an eligible expense in outdoor heritage fund projects. Those expenses that are direct and necessary to the support of a project. Supporting that, it's chapter 16, there's those statutes that says all expenses related to the project can be paid for. So there's a statutory framework that allows these expenses. There's a specific appropriation language that directs that these be direct and necessary, and there are policies and procedures that are implemented by the Minnesota Management of Budget that direct us on how we can devise and request these expenses. So, again, Mr. Chairman, I'd be delighted to go into the detail on these. I think that would be a little confounding. What I'd like to do is use a couple of examples. If you look at page 3 on the handout that you got, this is an example of an acquisition project that included acquisitions for WAs, SNAs, Native Prairie Bank, and had a total of requests of $4.9 million. As I mentioned, when we do acquisitions, the personnel element of this is relatively modest relative to the other expenses. So in this, we've got a $48,000 direct and necessary expense component. And you can see what that includes under the highlighting on page 3. It includes hiring, payroll, training, unemployment. It includes financial services like procurement, contracts, accounts, and so on. So that is what it takes to support this project beyond just having the individual doing the negotiations and the closing. And on the back, gives a little more example on that. But I want to compare that, Mr. Chairman, to the second example, which is the Aquatic Habitat Program Phase 5. In this example, we have a lot of personnel expenses because it's a labor-intensive type of activity. We've got 7.5 FTEs. So when you look at this, even though the project is roughly the same size in terms of total dollar amount, $5.2 million, the direct and necessary expenses are $188,000, almost 4 times as much as the previous example. So it is, again, still I would offer a fairly modest amount, but it is higher as a percentage of the project by virtue of the fact that there are a lot of people working on this project and they have a lot of support services. Mr. Chairman, so if I could direct your attention to the last page, which is the spreadsheet. It shows The calculations that we used, and again, we used a methodology that is recommended by the Office of Legislative Auditor and is comparable to what businesses would use in full cost accounting. The final column outlines what the calculated direct and necessary expenses would be for each of these projects that the department has put before you. So it ranges from, for instance, the Pelican Lake Enhancement on the bottom, zero, to as high as the third one from the top, Restoration Evaluation Program 6-3, 8.3%, because that's almost all salary. So the range of direct and necessary expenses from zero to well under 10%. But each of these, using this methodology, again, defines what the support costs are per project type. And so, Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'm asking today is your considered discussion about this, first off, so I can clarify anything that I haven't made sense on, but a recommendation or a decision on how to proceed with these direct and necessary expenses, because we will have them. This is a very challenging, complex set of calculations. I understand that. I will also offer that I know that all of the nonprofits have these comparable expenses. The organizations that I've been at has been as high as 25%. So this is not a unique situation with the department. What is unique for us is that no matter how we pay these expenses, they will come from the taxpayers of Minnesota and the license buyers of Minnesota, one way or another. And so it is a unique situation in that regard. But Mr. Chairman, I would submit to the council that we could we need to get these expenses paid somehow, some way. We can suggest to you an approach like this, which uses a formulaic process or a flat rate that perhaps ensures that we cover expenses. That might be simpler, but it does not necessarily reflect the actual costs on any individual project. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess at this point I would stand for questions. I appreciate the time the council has set up for this, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions.
Who's got questions? Scott?
Morning. You know, I wish I could find a way to just magically pluck these dollars out of the sky, pay for them some other way, but, you know, I understand that they're there. They're part of the process. Obviously, you know, my desire would be to keep them as low as possible, you know. You can maybe answer a question for me, and it's one I have just a little bit of experience with, and I think I'm accurate. You know, these direct expenses are all of the things that happen up the chain, from project initiation and on. And I did a little land acquisition down in Jackson County for an outfit called the Raleigh Sportsman's Club, and it was a 12-acre round out on an existing WMA. So Area Wildlife Manager came down. That's part of this process. They wrote up the fact sheet. They said that was good to go. They sent it to Ken Martin in New Orleans. And Ken signs off on it. I told Ken, I said, we're under the gun, you know, every acquisition's got to happen right away. They said, what's the process? He said, well, I have to send this around. It was signed off by everybody else. And they said, well, who's everybody else? He said, well, you know, the Department of Fisheries got to sign off. You know, and Lands and Minerals has got to sign off. And if it was in forestry, forestry would have to sign off. Okay, so he goes, I think we can maybe get this done in 2 weeks. Okay, so it happened. But my question comes down to is when we're looking at these direct expenses, this was a 12-acre roundout that every Trails and Waterways, which is Ecological Services, had to sign off. All of these entities that, in my estimation, had nothing to do or no input in a 12-acre roundout, those fees for those people to sign off are included in these direct expenses. Is there a way to streamline these processes? Would the department make a commitment to say, you know, I don't think fisheries needs to sign off on a 12-acre roundout, and somehow give Ken some authority to say, you know, let's keep our direct expenses low by not involving a whole bunch of people that don't really need to be involved? You know, is that... So to me, when I look at these and you say they're kind of low as a percentage of the overall, and I understand that's probably true, but I still look at that and say, you know, what could they actually be? And that's not just... My concern here isn't, or my question isn't with just the department. It's with anybody that would come and request funds. You know, how do we keep those fees as low as possible? Is there a way to streamline, or would, on the dollars that are running through this fund, could we make a conscious effort to eliminate all of the things that would not be, what a common man would not think are necessary in order to keep those direct expenses lower.
Critical things. And Mr. Chairman Scott, I think there are kind of three questions embedded in there. The first one is one that has perplexed me for a while, and that is, why in the world does it take the department so long to buy a piece of land? You know, I know from the nonprofit world, we've done them in 3 weeks, 4 weeks under the gun. We're at the point, in our words, taking 18 months doing an acquisition. I just find it, frankly, totally unacceptable. And so we are taking proactive steps to improve that. And two of them are, one is we work very closely, as you all know, with NGO nonprofit partners who can provide us additional capacity at acquiring land and do that generally quicker. We have refined our process for doing that over the last 2 years so that I think if you talk to the nonprofits now, at least publicly, they'll tell you that the system is better now than it has been in the past. And if there are improvements that we need to make to that third-party acquisition process, I'm still open for that. But I think majority of the acquisitions that are done by the state are still done by the DNR. And when I look at that, that amount of time is unacceptable. So we have engaged on a series of continuous improvement, business buzzwords, now continuous improvement processes to take that 18-month process and shorten that down as much as possible. Identify all the places that this process is stopping and delaying and sitting in somebody's inbox for a week while they're on vacation and making sure we eliminate that delay as much as possible. I would very much like to see us get to 6 months. If we got to a year, I'd be delighted that a year later if we got to a year. But squeezing out those efficiencies is something that we have just engaged and just embarked on. We have a new director of lands and minerals, Jess Richards, came to us from PCA. He is a black belt in Six Sigma, those of you who are familiar with that, which means that he knows how to go into these process improvement activities and squeeze out the delay and the fat. And so we're taking that on now. That will be probably a year-long process. But that is one of the parts of your question, Scott, is how do we squeeze that down and get the efficiency inefficiencies out of that. And we're embarking on that. The second is all of these other people that sign up. Unlike business, we have a bunch of statutory requirements in many cases that we have to follow in doing any of our activities, including acquisition. When other entities have to check off on it, if it isn't required, I'm committed to taking that out through that process improvement thing I just mentioned. When it is required, those costs don't land in here. If fisheries has to check off on it, if forestry has to check off on it, those are not included in department direct expenses. So you're not paying for those. They may slow the process down. Again, I think that in itself is unacceptable, but they aren't an expense that we're trying to capture here. And the third thing, I think, is the Department of Education.
If the department had its way, would you prefer, being at this council, were to take action, would you prefer these just to be a flat percentage of the appropriation, or would you prefer to go through your formula and attach each dollar as it goes? That's question one. The other one is when you say that you have to deal with these statutory things, I'm actually meeting with some burn people later in the week to see whether we can streamline some of the requirements for burning to make that a little easier. Does the department actually go and say, legislature, these statutes that you are putting us under are terribly burdensome. Do you actually go out and campaign to remove those or change those or deal with those? Or is it just kind of, this is what it is, this is what we've lived with, we'll deal with it?
Mr. Chairman Scott, some of all, I mean, there, you can ask the legislators here. I mean, they know that we've come to, not infrequently, with suggestions for how to streamline things. Often those contingencies are put in there to, make sure we're not doing something wrong or going overboard or whatever. And so there are some that we'll look at and we'll say, can we do things differently and try to streamline that? And just as an example, I don't digress too much, all of our timber sales activities is guided by Minnesota Statutes Chapter 90. We've just done a full brushing of that view of that chapter, and we're looking for those inefficiencies that we can take out. We're going to bring that as a package to the legislation. So we do that, but there are, one of the, to the essence of your question, flat rate versus a variable rate. State buys things generally under two categories. One is by contract and one is by grant. Contract is done under sort of bidding process where you and I both bid on the same job. We put a number out there. And it is what we have to look at in reviewing contracts is what's below the bid. And we take it. We don't sort of go in there and say, well, you're charging 5% for indirect here and you're charging 6% there. You don't do that under contracting. The contract needs all the non kind of a deal. Versus grants, which is what we all operate under through this process. What we get here are grants. And grants identify specific categories of expenses. And all you can pay for is the actual expenses of those grants. So if we were to use a flat rate, this, we could still only ask for those expenses that are eligible and get into that flat rate. So let's just say, for argument's sake, you pick the recommendation here, 3.3%. Some of our projects will have 0% indirect expense. We won't capture any of that because we have to do an itemized billing for those grant dollars, so we can't ask for that. However, we might have another project that has 8%, and now we'd be capped at 3%. So I can make a solid argument for flat rate because it is simpler. It's easier to understand. People get it. But it is not necessarily equitable to the expenses of the project.
Jane?
Could you create a tiered system? Like this type of project? I mean, you pointed out some good examples here. That, heavy personnel obviously have more direct support services. Would there be some way to parse them into, maybe two or three categories that would be easy to understand and fair?
Mr. Chairman, Jane, I think what I've seen in people work in some nonprofits is what they, since most of these direct and necessary expenses are associated with salary dollars,
right,
they will use an indirect recovery rate to each salary dollar. So if you're labor intensive, you draw more. If you're labor inintensive, you draw less. That is an approach you can take, and what we try to do is really explicitly identify each of those expenses rather than start out with a less transparent rate. But if the council so directed, we could surely come up with a number and provide that.
Scott?
Could the council, if it wanted to, you indicated that when I was thinking of flat rate, whatever percentage that is, I was just going to assume that that was across the board on appropriation. But you're saying in one that had zero, you couldn't recover anything from that. And if it was 8%, you'd get clipped on the top side of that one. Do we have the ability, if the council would choose to do so, to allow the department and just say it's X percent across the board? Okay, you don't have to. I mean, if it's a 0%, you still get to collect the 2.6. But if it's 8, you collect 2.6, whatever that figure might be, and give them the ability to recapture, as a flat rate percentage, even on appropriations where those would actually be zero.
My belief is that we are recommending a strategy to the legislature, and it's well within our ability to recommend that a flat rate be used across the board. The legislature can always decide they don't like that. But if there is a logic behind it, I would think that we would be listened to. We may not be agreed with, but we would be listened to. But I don't think there's any prohibition against us setting a flat rate instead of doing an actual cost recovery method, as long as it was fair.
If we use a flat rate, where you didn't have to do the calculations, you didn't have to bill it all back, would that actually make direct expenses go down because you wouldn't be doing the calculations? Or would you still have to do those internally for each department anyway?
No, Mr. Chairman, Scott, we'd probably still have to do the calculations. I don't think the total cost of that is that high. I mean, we have a financial analyst who will look at each project and say, okay, this expense, this direct and necessary cost, I don't know what that takes for the lease, maybe for all of these projects on an annual basis. So that won't dramatically reduce expenses. I think, to get to that suggested or that potential flat rate amount would be quite easy. And again, if you look at this, you see what the total LSOHC allocation is. You see what the total direct and necessary expenses are. You can just do a simple division there and come up with a percentage that if the legislature, if the legislature said that this is an eligible rate, presumably, they can say that.
Wes?
Commissioner, Tom?
I look at your department as probably more efficient in being to identify the detailed costs. I think what I'm seeing is when you go through all the projects, you are all over the place, and maybe you're coming up with a fixed percentage or a variable percentage, depending on the type of project, would be a benefit to dictate what the cost would be allowable up to the NGOs. And myself, as a enterprise of supposedly profit, that's our indicator. When we did a project, we had to take like Bowser rates. We were kind of in the gray area as far as not knowing what to charge for the project. And yeah, we could break it down in detail, but as a small business, we don't have the capability of necessarily do that. We look at when it's all done, what have we got in the bottom line left? So I think what you're doing would be a very good indicator to what we can apply to the other NGOs and the other contractors as a reasonable rate of recovery of direct costs. If it's easier, and of course you're going to be looking at the higher percentages, the 8.3s, the 7.3s is where you're going to aim for improving the efficiencies along with streamlining, and we would be doing the same thing, but at least we'd have a kind of a roadmap to go by. Just to come.
Mr. Chairman, members of the council, I want to make sure that I'm clear that I'm looking for cost efficiency, regardless of what we have here on the rate. We need to be as efficient as possible, and that's an ongoing continuous improvement thing in the department. These rates, I think, reflect what would be at the outside. The 8.3% is at the outside of what we'd anticipate for the direct and necessary expenses for the department. I do know that, in the nonprofit world, there's also a number called federally approved indirect rate, and you've probably all heard that. That's where each of these national nonprofits goes to the Department of Interior, and they use an accounting process that says, here's what their indirect rate is on expenses. That's probably in the 25% range. I think the state has an indirect rate as well. That's 21%. But that's for projects that go to the federal government. If I want to get a grant from the Department of Interior, I say, well, I need $1 million for the project expenses, and by the way, I need $210,000 for the indirect expenses. So there is another process out there that is more comprehensive than this, but by virtue of the fact that it's approved by the federal government, it has got some auditable veracity to it.
Jane?
Yeah, the 3.36%. You're talking about the average of the different division direct rates. Is that just for this year's worksheet here that we've approved?
Okay, Mr. Chair, that is for the information provided by the department to us for the upcoming round.
For this round?
Right.
I came up with a different average. Is yours a weighted average?
No. What did you come up with?
Let's see, my Evelyn public school system math tells me 2.63. That's just a straight average.
But the division direct rates, I think we need to recalculate.
But I'd like to talk about weighted average, too. I think that makes a difference.
Okay.
So, we don't have to talk about it now.
What Jane is referring to, Mr. Chair, is the suggested motion on the agenda item memo. It's taken into account many of the comments that have been brought up in discussion. And I want to start off with just reciting the laws we've written it for the past 5 years, and this applies to other trust funds as well. And it's money appropriated in this section may not be spent on activities unless they are directly related to and necessary for a specific appropriation and are specified in the accountable plan approved by the Hazard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. Money appropriated in this section must not be spent on indirect costs or other institutional overhead charges that are not directly related to and necessary for a specific appropriation. And the idea of the motion in the agenda item memo is to further define that so that it would limit direct support service charges to 3.36% of the sum of personnel, other equipment and tools and supplies and material and material budget items. So you would take a look at each budget, seeing what personnel was, what the supplies, expenses, and things like that were. This gets rid of the large, low support service cost items, like acquisition and contracts.
Mr. Chairman and members of council, if you look at the examples that I gave you as well, it lists what the department direct support is on the front page of the bottom of page 3. Typically, the department expenses are greater than division expenses because that's where our human resources is held, that's where information technology is held, that's where legal is held. And so separating out the division support versus the two, department and direct, covers only a portion of it at a maximum.
Mr. Chair,
please.
The discussions that led to the suggested motion considered department direct, but figured that that was more distant from the actual project and therefore less direct. So if there was a place to draw a line, it's between division direct, which is close to the delivery of the project, and department direct, which is more akin to indirect cost.
And then it says 3.36 is the average of fish and wildlife, ecological and water resources have, not lands and minerals, but FO, what is FO?
Forestry.
And that's part of lands and minerals? Or what? Lands and minerals is on this, but it's not. Okay.
Well, and I, just to clarify, I think the reason we came up with a different number, we took, our math was a percentage of the entire appropriation, and Bill's, or whoever put this together, the 3.36% was a percentage of only certain line items within the accomplishment plan. And that's why this came out a little bit different.
Yep.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, obviously, including land as part of your number that you're calculating off of doesn't make as much sense as things that you're actually spending the money on, the personnel space is tied up.
And Mr. Chairman, the other category that I typically look at is maybe we're at the high contract versus the agent counter, very high contract cost. So that we don't have the personnel support costs with that we would if we were doing that work ourselves. So we got acquisition, we got contracting, and then we got the direct being our employees. So I see those as sort of three different categories of the level of indirect expenses.
Scott?
Does the chair have a recommendation on how to move forward on this? There's a motion kind of in here. Is that one you would
that
like
was,
to entertain?
That was the one that Jim and I came up with, for better or worse. Talking about how to come to you, because this is as many times as I've been through it, every time I go through it I get confused. It's a very complex issue, and I think frankly we'd be far better off to set a percentage and make it a standard, and then revisit it every couple of years to say is it the right percentage, rather than try to go through the calculation of each project, because then we know what it is over and over. But that's our recommendation. It doesn't have to be what you accept. As you have proven before, you will do as you want to do.
Call somebody then I'll come back to me or I'll
go
you.
Right ahead.
Would we run this percentage with the NGOs and also as a recommender?
That would be an option as well.
Yeah. I think it'll standardize things a lot.
Sure.
Tom, if the council approved a 3.36 across the board on those items, you know, that was calculated from, would you feel that the department was being adequately compensated based on that figure? For the work you're doing?
So, Mr. Chairman, Scott, I guess a couple of thoughts. I don't know where that number came from. If it Again, you looked at that spreadsheet at the back, and you summed up the total Russian asset expenses, and you took it as a percentage of the LSOE. So you took second to the rate column, and you took that as a percentage of the first column on the left. And that was, I don't know what that number is, I should have somebody calculate that. But if that's the number, then I'd say, as a package, yes, that's being taken care of. But again, I would have those caveats that I, unless the legislature so directs, that 3.3 becomes a cap. It doesn't become an average. We can't apply it to a project that has, you know, 0% indirect or direct necessary expenses. And we can only apply it to 3.3% on a project that has 8.3%. But if you took one flat amount and did a line item and said, this amount is for direct and necessary expenses, it can be done that way. But if it is a percentage of each project, I think we still run into the granting challenges. And that's why I pointed out that, you know, the way a grant works versus a contract works.
So, just as the devil's advocate for that, if you used a flat percentage and you got 3.36% on something that you have zero cost for, but somewhere else you knew you had more, and we were deliberately playing the averages, what's wrong with that?
No, Mr. Chairman, I think that's fine. I just don't know that will work, and maybe council can advise on this. I don't think that will work in a state grant situation. We can't ask for reimbursement on something we didn't spend.
Danny?
Well, thank you. I'm trying to understand this, and I'm not following it. And I noticed Mr. Noble's not in the audience, which I certainly hope that we make sure he listens to the tape. Commissioner, I've got just a couple different scenarios. So if you had $1 million project and you supposedly were going to have this 3.36%, I get that's like $33,000, $633,600. Well, if your actual direct costs were either, which they probably won't be that amount, but if the actual were $20,000 more, let me first ask you, who's going to pay that? What fund are you going to take that $20,000? So you had direct costs that were $20,000 more for a Lessard Sands project. What pot of money is that $20,000 going to come from?
Mr. Chairman and Representative McNamara, if it's a direct expense, it should be captured in that $1 million. So if we have a negotiator, if we have an appraisal, if we have a land cost, that all fits in that $1 million. That would be part of our request. If it comes in higher, if the land comes in at $1.1 million, well, now we have to look somewhere else. But the direct and necessary expenses that we don't calculate are the IT person behind that. Just as I mean, say there's a bunch of GIS work involved with this, and so we have a GIS person who does a bunch of work to put this project over board. If we don't have direct and necessary expenses covered there, every dime they spend is an unreimbursable expense. So that GIS person will be paid for based on where they're housed, essentially. So if it's a forestry person, it'll be a division of forestry taking a hit. If it's a fish and wildlife person, it'll be a division of fish and wildlife taking a hit. And so that will be paid for, to the earlier point, by funds that were not allocated to the department specifically for Outdoor Heritage Fund project implementation.
And where would potentially those, where would you take that money from? Game and fish funds or trying?
Depending on the nature of the project, if it was a wildlife management area, presumably it would be the game and fish fund. If it was a scientific and natural area, it would either be general funds or some other dedicated fund like the reimagining account or something.
Well, Commissioner, I'm going to go back to the same thing. You're supposed to get reimbursed for all the costs on the project. I don't think you can pick some percentage. We can't pick a percentage that we think, well, it'll average out. I'm sorry, that's not allowed. If there's cost involved in a project, they should be paid for by the project instead of robbing the money from somewhere else. You shouldn't get overpaid for more costs than you got. And if you don't want to keep track of your time and don't want to keep track of IT costs and such, and I get that you're going to maybe do some calculation to best determine, but you have to do that. You have to keep track This is required to only get paid what it's supposed to get paid, not overpaid, not be underpaid. And the legislative auditor is going to watch that. He's not going to accept picking 3.36%. He's going to find a project where your actual costs were less. He's going to make it be repaid. He's not going to accept that. I think us having a discussion about some percentage we're going to pick, you've been before this body, the legislature, and I'm assuming in the Senate, the same thing. You're supposed to put the direct costs on. We can't pick some percentage and say we think, yes, it should be this, that, or whatever. You have to do what you have to do and satisfy Jim Noble and the legislature, and you're doing it correct. If we buy something, the cost associated with it, I don't get how we're supposed to pick some percentage and guess what? We're asking you, do you think that percentage? I'm sorry. You and I were duck hunting the last 2 days. We weren't calculating the percentage of overhead or whatever. I mean, you got people that do that, and you got to do it in the right way. Mr. Chair, I don't get what this is. This whole discussion, he's got to satisfy that they're costed appropriately. As far as getting in the weeds and just getting exactly what little IT cost, you have to be able to justify to Mr. Noble that you did it appropriately and right. Not, you didn't try and go too high, you didn't try and go too low. We are not an NGO. An NGO, you can negotiate some percentage. You can't take money from Game and Fish and use it for Lessard Samson. You can't take Lessard's money and use it for Game and Fish or expect you're going to get general fund for some SNA you underfunded. I don't get where this discussion's coming from. You know what you're supposed to do, and you got number crunchers over there that can figure it out, and they should just be scared Noble in the legislature that they're doing it right. And that's going to direct them to do the right thing. And again, if you're not keeping track of yours and the deputy commissioner's time, I don't understand. You're the most valuable people we have, and if you're out on the Lessard Sands project negotiating at a kitchen table with somebody to buy that land, I don't understand why your time is not appropriate, because you're making somebody else pay for it, and I don't think that's right.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I could agree with you more. The reason we brought before you a process rather than a flat rate percentage is because that is the most specific to the project approach. So what we've shown you is a process, and I understand that it gives you different percentages on the nature of the project. That is, to your point, that is the nature of the project. And while the Jim Nobles has not looked at this and said, yes, everything you've done here is absolutely correct, he has looked at this process and said, yes, that's the appropriate approach for the department to take.
Okay.
I was hoping we could do something simple, and I don't think we can either. And I think Tom said you have to go through all those calculations anyway. And the other thing is, this is not just restricted to the DNR projects. I mean, I think whatever we do has to be done so that it suits all of the applicants, whether they're a tribe or whether they're a trust for public land or TNC or any of them. So I don't know very many people who enjoy going through human resources types of exercises unless you're in it. And even if you're in it, I can tell you, you don't necessarily enjoy it. But maybe we should have a committee that does something to look at these processes so that we don't take up the greater council time. But, you know, if you use this year's slate of projects, that's one set of numbers. Next year it's going to be different. I mean, there's so many variables. You know, I think it's more important to focus on a process that's accepted and that's understood and blessed in some ways. And I'm sure that every organization has their own process, but there's got to be a lot of similarities in the two. So I don't know. I don't think that the flat rate is going to work. And I think the hard work has to be done somewhere. Because it is state law and because it is state money. Every hierarchy is going to have those overhead costs in varying amounts depending on the project.
Mr. Shipman, if I could, I'm sure that the concern, because the chair is concerned, is that if you crack the door open, you open the floodgates. And in my estimation, the way to do that is to put a cap. So a rear cap might be 10%, 8%, whatever that is. But a process that devised by the council, a process devised the project specific rate not to exceed such a number.
Any other? What would you like to do?
silence.
It appears that the only thing we can do is to continue to look at those accomplishment plans, you know, or at least those requests for appropriations as they come in, look for the efficiencies that they're, you know, that they're presenting us, and make appropriation allocation decisions based on what we perceive those efficiencies to be, because it doesn't appear that we're going to be able to formulate any long-term percentage or other methods. So it's just a matter I thought if we could use a percentage, and then somebody else came in under that. No, just because we approved 3.6, if somebody came in at 1.5, we'd say, well, boy, there's an organization that's very efficient. We should consider funding them. And using the efficiencies in the direct services category as a factor in helping us decide or come to a conclusion as to who's most efficient, but it does not appear, based on the conversations that we've had today, that any part of that is feasible.
Might I suggest that what the council could do is approve the methodology that the department has forwarded for this round. If you want to put a cap on it, that's fine, but we know what that results in. It results in $23 million appropriation with $600,000 in direct support services, and it's defined by program. So by accepting the department's methodology, you accept approximately 8%.
And Brittany's working faster than mine, Bill.
3%.
2.6.
$600,000 it's under 5%. A million would be 5%. So it's 4%.
So you're approving approximately a 3% rate.
I move that motion.
Bullet number one on the.
I forward bullet number one.
There's a motion to approve bullet number one. What bullet number one?
I have no idea.
Page one of the agenda item memo. And it's a motion to forward the upcoming recommendations to the legislature with the language shown above, approving the method of estimating the amounts listed in the table.
Yes. We have that motion on the floor. Any discussion? Yeah, it's left.
Denny, we probably can't use a fixed percentage in a governmental agency. It just won't work. Yes, it'll get a lot more detail, but it'll give us a yardstick to measure what the NGOs are doing, and it'll be, I think, a little better, and give us a little better information to find out what perimeters to fall within. I think it'd be a good tool.
And I might add, the language above referenced is the language in the first paragraph in quotes, which comes out of the appropriation as well.
Okay.
So that means that the direct support services will only be paid on these projects and not the others? Is that right?
In these amounts for DNR, DNR certifies the direct support services will pass through. I assume DNR will be no harder on the pass through than they are on themselves.
Is this in addition to what we've already recommended in the appropriations?
No, it would have to come out of the
individual projects incorporated in those individual recommended amounts?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, it is already in the budget being recommended amendments.
Okay, what about non-DNR projects that have direct support services, those just stand as is?
Unless you want to do something about it. We're going to have a discussion about a confidence plan, and you can pull out anyone that you want to talk about specifically. We can, I think it's probably the horses out of the barn on this round of appropriations, but we can set guidance for future appropriations for non-state funds for a cap of what this would be?
Well, if what we had originally, you know, the ones that did list direct support services, I had PNC, Bird Conservancy, Audubon, I think, MBHA, Department of Agriculture, PNC, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I think those are the only ones that did. And they were all well below or well within these. I think the highest ones would be in our numbers. So.
It's up to the council.
Yeah.
Mr.
Chairman. Scott?
I mean, my understanding is that Tom is back today making an explanation of how they came up with their direct support services because they are, in total dollars, so much higher than any other applicant that, or requester that we've had. You know, there's nothing new in these numbers. They're already included in all of that stuff that's been approved, but that this was kind of a special case. We certainly can look at other ones individually when their accomplishment plans come up, but this was basically a point of information, how we came up with what we did to clarify for the council what's cost.
And an acceptance of that. Yeah. You could dispute it if you wanted to.
And I have not. I have the motion on the table.
I'm just giving you the options. Any other discussion yet?
Can I ask, Mr. Chair, is the effort here is what we're trying to do is to streamline the BNR to have less overhead expenses? Is that what we're trying to actually do to get them to act more efficiently and to compete more with the other groups? Don't we do that by not funding projects for them and having TNC do the project because their costs are lower? I'm trying to understand what we're doing here. We have no choice. The direct costs that you incur have to be paid out of the projects. We can't artificially pick a number and say that's what your direct costs are going to be. We cannot fund the project because you're too expensive to do it and use the money on a different project or have somebody else do the project. What are we trying to do here by us getting in the weeds and saying your direct cost can only be that much?
I think we're trying to understand what they are because it's been very confusing in how they're calculated. I think it can frame the future discussion about how this is competitive with NGOs doing the work or not. I think it is within our purview to push back and say, wait a second, we think this one's too high. You need to come back and justify this in a way that you haven't to date because it doesn't make sense to us. I'm not sure this is the point in these projects to do that, but we could.
Mr. Chairman, I think to try to get a couple of points by Representative Maskin and Mr. Rall, these direct and necessary expenses were built into our proposal. So the projects that you have recommended for approval already incorporate these expenses in them. It's not something we're coming back with your proposal to add that on now. What, to the point that was made, what we're asking today is that you have approved these, but you don't know how we came up with that number. So what we're asking you today is, can you concur with how we came up with that number? So when the recommendation is made, this is everybody is understanding and everybody is in agreement that these are real expenses that are going to be reimbursed by the Upper Heritage Fund.
So we can approve Scott's motion for having withdraw it and approve the accomplishment plans, which would accomplish exactly the same thing because it's already embedded in the projects. It's just not on a single piece of paper. But essentially, this is where we're at, and we now have a better understanding of how we got there.
Mr. Chair, it's almost the same thing. What the motion that Scott had does is proves the methodology that the department has developed. That methodology would then be the subject of the auditor's work. Without that methodology, he's where he was before, trying to figure out whether rent's something you can, an expense you can pay or not, which was one of the examples he used after his last audit. Our attempt here working with the department was to provide some sideboards for the auditor, but maybe it's premature.
Well, I mean, we can get into the weeds even more, but you specifically write in here that rent can be or is included. We've already had that discussion. Sometimes it will be and sometimes it won't. I think you already know that. I think an honest discussion of whether you're the right organization to do a specific project or do a different project because you're too expensive is the big picture that this group should be dealing with. I mean, I don't have a problem with trying to whack overhead. I hate overhead. But the reality is you're different. Because if you underbill Lazard Sam's, Eamon Fish is going to pay for it, or the general fund is, or the kids are going to get less textbooks. We can't do that. TNC, we can make them go hit up some big donor for more cash or go sell more bake sales or whatever they do to get their money. It doesn't work in this case, and you're different, and that's why we need to keep whacking your overhead. I get that in the big picture so you can be more competitive. But however we do it, I just want to be careful where we're going.
Wayne?
I believe one of our options is to take no action, correct?
We are going to take an action on Scott's motion unless he withdraws it,
correct.
In which case one of our actions could be to do nothing.
And what I'm looking at here is we're at the tail end of the process for this year. And next year, now in January, we're going to be a new call is going out. And I'm wondering if this isn't something which we should be discussing January, February, March, April, when the call goes out, and then be able to tell everybody, NGOs, state government, federal government, everybody, that this is kind of our expectation. And wait until then. I'm still confused about everything we've been discussing here, so I would personally like to see us wait a little bit.
But there, you do have to hear what Bill said, which is this lets the auditor audit to this year's recommendation, this year's appropriation. So the DNR is saying this is what they're going to spend this year, and the auditor now has a criteria by which to measure, which if we take no action, they have to make it up again.
So we're talking 2011 allocation?
We're talking about the one that we're working on right now.
Okay.
Not last year's and not next year's. We're talking about this particular unit. Scott?
You know, and I mean, the motion that's on the table in no way is attempting to reduce the department's indirect costs. I mean, we're approving those as they were submitted, which they're already in the accomplishment plan. It's just approving the methodology so that the auditor can move forward based on our criteria of what was acceptable and what was not. And I don't think this is rocket science. I think it's pretty easy.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just offer one thought on that. The auditor, who I think very highly of, is a very busy person. He won't pro forma advise on a process. Only after we have actually implemented it will he go back in and say, yes, this is correct. He said you are taking the right approach, but he has not gone into the detail and said, no, that's wrong and this is right. So to the point, once this is approved by the legislature, that gives the auditor the trigger at which he can go in and say, okay, DNR, you really screwed up here, or no, this is right, or whatever. So it is a very legitimate point that getting something for the auditor to look at will be the first point where we can really come back to and say, look, here's certification that the auditor agrees.
So we have a motion on the table to approve bullet point one on page one of agenda item 9. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed.
Opposed.
Motion carried. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, members, very much. Appreciate it. And good luck with the rest of the deliberations.
Where else can you have more fun than you had today?
Today would have been the day to be on the river duck. Not the day before.
That's always the case, Tom.
No. All right, members, next is a discussion of the accomplishment plans. To move forward to the appropriations bill. Bill, I'll turn this over to you for some initial comments, and then we'll open it up for questions.
We have an agenda item memo again for this particular item. What we're doing is
progressing the draft of conflict of plans. This is to allow us to have a firm basis for writing the appropriation recommendation law or bill, and to describe what is going to be accomplished by the expenditure of this money to the legislature. The final approval of the accomplishment plans occurs after the legislature has worked its will and done what it thinks is best with regard to our recommendation. And then we'll go back and adjust the accomplishment plans to the final bill as signed by the governor. And it will be approved in the June meeting. Heather? Can you provide just a little background data on the accomplishment plans? And you've worked the most closely with these program managers.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the council, we've worked the last month or so with all the project managers and making sure that the data that was included in the proposal migrated safely and accurately over into the accomplishment plans. I just want to take a moment to thank Sandy for all the hard work that she's done with the new online system. It has greatly, greatly improved our efficiency and the accuracy of our work. And I think the feedback that we've received from project managers would support that as well. So thanks for a great job with this new online system. Because of the accuracy of the migration of the data, there wasn't a lot of changes that needed to be made to the accomplishment plan, except in the area of budget and outcomes, and budget and output from some of the parcel list data, too. So you'll see much of the same similar information. Obviously, all of it was scaled to the appropriation recommendations that were being made by the council. In summary, though, I just want to point out a couple of things to you. We've done some preliminary analysis, and we'll have a much fuller explication at the next meeting in December. But the total number of acres affected under this year's proposed recommendations are close to 98,000 acres. Of that, the largest component is in the area of easement acres. There are over 12,500 acres to be acquired in easement, and acres acquired via acquisition, almost 10,000 acres will be acquired that way. Restore acres are almost 2,000 acres, and the number of acres being enhanced are over 73,000. 73,000. I can send a spreadsheet to you too, if you'd like, ahead of the next meeting. The other thing I wanted to point out, again, is that the recommendations are highly invested in the prairie regions of the state. Of the 86,887,000 being recommended, over 35, almost 36,000 are in the prairie area, 20,000 in wetlands, forests, about 6,500,000, and in habitats, over almost $24 million will be invested in those areas.
So we assume that you read all the accomplishment plans. We've asked the program managers to be here to answer questions if you have questions. Otherwise, the motion that we're looking for is on the agenda item memo, which is to direct us to proceed based on the draft accomplishment plans as presented.
So with that, are there any questions, Wayne? Anything you want to
move the motion?
Wayne moves the motion. Are there any discussions anybody wants to have about any of the projects in the accomplishment plan? Jim?
David, I have a question on the grasslands for the future,
which is project 2A.
2A. In the accomplishment plan, they describe an option where they're going to use a conservation fund to acquire land and feed title. Blah, 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 blah. Well, this was never described. This was never part of the original presentation. This is new since this process was brought before us, and I don't understand how this got it's like a new project all of a sudden.
These are the program managers coming to the table to testify.
So please identify yourselves and
sure.
Kim, maybe you can start since it's.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tim Kohler, and I'm with the Board of Soil and Water Resources.
Sarah Sperman with the Minnesota Land Trust.
And I am Steve Hobbs with the Conservation Fund.
Thanks for taking the time and trying to understand the proposal better. We, Mr. Chairman and members, we sensed a little bit of confusion and maybe a little bit of misunderstanding of how the proposal was written or what our intention was. And I think the first thing that I just wanted to say in a big picture way is that when you asked us to consider doing this at the last meeting, and we truly view this as a pilot. So some of the things we're going to be talking about, we're hoping it's going this direction or that direction or whatever, but we really don't know some of this until we get a little bit further into it. But what we did was we put a fact sheet together that made an attempt at explaining the process, tried to step you through the outcomes and what we're tending to evaluate, and then also talk about a few of the points with the pilot mechanics that we anticipate trying to work as we're working with private landowners. And specific to the process itself, Sarah with MLT, as well as Steve with the Conservation Fund, and Bowser, you know, we put this together and we kind of have a framework to how it would work. And I guess maybe Steve, if you wanted to try to directly answer Jim's question, or Sarah, I mean, process standpoint. Go ahead.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Mr. Cox. I'm Steve Hobbs with the Conservation Fund. The idea would be, in terms of our involvement, for those opportunities that we have to acquire land that is important in terms of the prairie plan, that is land that a producer has identified as land that they are willing to graze in, as conservation grazing, an easement that we've put on the property. But the concept is to kind of get ahead of what's happening we're seeing on the landscape in terms of all this land that is being sold, that the Conservation Fund is willing to use its own revolving fund to acquire those lands and then subsequently sell an easement to the state using legacy funds. And then at the same time, hopefully in more or less a simultaneous closing, then pass that property on that now has an easement on it to a local producer that they would use it for conservation grazing. So the idea of our involvement is only in those cases where there is land for sale, the current landowner is not willing to put a conservation easement over it, we are willing to step in and acquire those lands, get an easement in place, and then subsequently pass it on to a local producer for their ultimate ownership with that easement in place that would mandate conservation grazing.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Cox, if I might just add directly to your question about is this a change from the original proposal, I think our position is this is still an easement program. It's just that there may be some, and in the end result, the outcome is a conservation easement on important grassland habitat. The issue is, as Steve described, there may be cases where we have a particular parcel targeted as in a high priority area where the owner may be wanting to self-retitle, not a conservation easement. So the conservation fund, by purchasing the property and then selling the easement, would be the mechanism in which we achieve that ultimate goal. So the goal is actually absolutely the same. It's looking at different options for the mechanism of getting there.
But doesn't he add another cost now? Doesn't the conservation fund, doesn't that add another cost? Because you're going to benefit financially from this transaction, the conservation fund, won't they?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cox, when we wrote the original proposal as a partner in this, we were mentioned as being a partner. So it was always our intention to assist in whatever way we can, and our expertise is in buying land, using a revolving fund, and holding it until such time that we can pass it on to another NGO or the state or federal agency. All we're looking for in this process is really having any of our costs incurred in doing that transaction covered. So that's what you see in the budget, is whatever costs you might incur in putting together those deals, including appraisal costs and everything else. That's part of our cost that we want to see as best we can recover, so that we can go on and hopefully do this again with other projects. In this case, we're hoping what we're going to add to the process of conservation, that's really our only goal, certainly, is to be able to have a mechanism to step in and acquire those lands that we're seeing being sold rapidly in this area. Already just a few months that we've been talking about this project, there are two pieces of land that would have been very beneficial to conserve that we've now seen sold and will surely be in row crop soon. So our role is to just be able to step in as best we can to facilitate that.
So where in the original proposal was the conservation fund mentioned? Because I didn't see it.
I believe we were listed as just one of the partners in the original proposal. And we didn't specify exactly the mechanism that we would be using, just because we didn't. And I'd apologize, I guess, for that. We really weren't specific in terms of what our role was going to be. But that was certainly the
intent. There was nothing in terms of the budget that identified anything to the conservation fund. So how is this? I think Jim's point is, how did this change? And the other question I have is just, what assurance do we have that the conservation fund doesn't buy the land for $100,000, sell an easement for $50,000, sell the land for $70,000 and pocket money? Because the whole reason, on a personal level, I was supportive of this was to drive down the cost of protecting land and not to create an opportunity for profit.
Mr. Chair and council members, in the original proposal budget under the Minnesota Land Trust partner portion of the budget, there was a contract line item for $80,000, and that was the intended part for the conservation fund. Originally, it was conceived as a contract from the Minnesota Land Trust to the conservation fund. When we went to the accomplishment plan stage in discussions with staff, we pulled that out, one, to be more transparent so that you would be able to see where the conservation fund was, and two, really it made more sense for the conservation fund to directly have a contract or a grant through Bowser rather than passing the money through Bowser and then through the land trust and out to the conservation fund. So that's where it was in the original proposal. To answer your question about the insurances, it is our intent, and that's part of really our goal in the pilot, is to better understand the costs of protecting grassland habitat in an agricultural landscape where we have very high commodity prices. And so that's why we want to look at different options and mechanisms for acquiring the easement. We have, as we noted in the fact sheet, committed that we will report on all the transaction costs, not only of the easement transactions, but if there's an intermediate fee title transaction, to be fully transparent so we can basically get the information that we wanted to get and assure that there isn't some profit being taken out.
I didn't see anything in the plan that specifically said if there was a profit, it would come back to the council. Is that your intention?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to address that as a member of the Conservation Fund. First of all, I guess looking at the deals that we're contemplating right now, I don't anticipate there's going to be any profit made because we're going to be buying land to be competitive. We're going to be buying land essentially at its full fair market value initially. And then the idea is that we would have the easement appraised, whatever that is, we would be compensated for the value of the easement and then subsequently would sell that land to a local producer for whatever the fair market value is. So at best, what I'm anticipating is that we're going to come out even on our initial purchase. I also think that, there is some risk on our part in terms of using our own capital invested in these projects that we might lose money on the back end. And we're willing to take that risk as a conservation if something were to happen and that we were involved in some of these transactions, using our own dollars to acquire these lands, selling the easement to the state, and then subsequently we're selling the land to a local producer, there was still a profit, quote unquote. We are happy to take those, that profit money and roll it back into doing more prairie conservation in the state. We're not trying to make any kind of, this is not a speculative venture on the conservation fund's part to try to get money anyway. That's really not our intent at all.
Mr. Chairman, may I also, again, the questions are great, and from a pilot perspective, as I started, we're anticipating this costing less than our regular process that we would do, because the landowner could come in and just ask for a RIM easement or an MLT easement, and the conservation fund may not be involved at all. In those situations, we probably would have a more usual cost, if you will. In this other option, we're hoping that we can, the premise we're running under here is that it would, even with the $75,000 accounted for, we would still save money and get the easement at a cheaper rate than if we had done it just with either MLP or without. Again, that's kind of what you asked us to test, if you will, you know, here a month or two ago. And we're hoping that that's the way it's going to go. If it costs more money, in the long run, then it's probably an effort that you may not be interested in looking at in the future if it's costing more money. If it saves us money, and the more important part, if it can take advantage of a sale that's going to happen tomorrow and protect that critical habitat, that grassland habitat, and not lose it because somebody doesn't want to take an easement, they want to just sell the land. That's the beauty of having a conservation fund. Is just
I'm deeply appreciative of someone who can act in less than a year and a half.
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, for lack of a parcel list, am I looking at the target areas on the criteria as being your potential parcel list, and you're aiming at Polk County and the Minnesota River Project?
Mr. Chair, that's right now, those are the areas that we've been focusing on in terms of meeting all the criteria that we list in the fact sheet, in terms of the proximity to conserved lands, as well as, in particular, finding operators who have some experience in conservation grazing and are willing to own land that would be encumbered by these easements. So right now, that's the initial focus.
I stepped out for just a second. I've looked at this project a little more in depth than many others, but did you guys bring along that summary plan description of what that conservation easement would be? Can we take a look at that? You know, I told them, I said, conservation grazing is great, but this project still has to have lots of wildlife value. So if the conservation easement says, don't put it to rough rot, graze it to it until it's a golf green, that doesn't have any wildlife value. Now, it certainly has clean water benefits. It has other issues, but it isn't a game, fish, and wildlife benefit first and foremost. So I asked him to put together a bullet point of what that might be. Graze one third for 2 months, graze another third for 2 months, graze the last third for 2 months, you know, in order to make sure that there was some seasonal habitats available on that property throughout the wildlife benefit seasons, or at least the nesting seasons. And so this is my first look at that. That's why I asked for this.
So, Mr. Chairman and members, and Scott, thank you. And maybe I'll have either Sarah or Steve talk specific to the one pager that we're sending, that we just sent around. But a couple of important points, and again, this is a pilot, so we don't have any language written up yet. Here are some examples of what the Conservation Fund has used out west, as well as USDA has used with the Grassland Reserve Program. And the easement is, you know, typical easement. It's 10 pages long, and it talks about all sorts of other stuff. But specific to the use of the land, it basically ties the easement holder to manage the land based on a plan. expansions, and here's the details, Scott, as you and I have talked a little bit about, too. Wildlife is number one. Wildlife habitat is number one. If we were saying these were water quality easements, we would be talking to the Clean Water Fund. If we were talking of production agriculture, we would be seeking easements through some other funding source. So, again, it's important to note that we're focusing on wildlife habitat, number one. Sure, there's 100 other secondary benefits that we're going to get, including the potential for a grazer to utilize the cover in certain circumstances. So some of and maybe let me just hit on kind of the, well, maybe I should, see, why don't you talk about bigger picture on easements, and I'll get into how tall the grass has to stay, you know, or when it has to stay that high, or whatever, so.
Mr. Chair, members, what was being passed around is, as Tim said, it's really just examples that we've used elsewhere. The first one is an example of an easement that we have in Colorado in a similar situation, in that there is a producer and there's going to be conservation grazing on the property. And then that's really what I included in here, is just in the pertinent paragraph that talks about how that works in the Colorado case. And then the grassroots easements, those are the federal easements that have similar provisions in terms of making sure that the bottom line is that these areas would be conserved as wildlife habitat. And certainly when we get down to brass tacks, the easement we're talking about here in Minnesota, that's exactly what will be the bottom line, is that these areas will be preserved as grassland habitat. They will allow grazing as a management tool, but it'll be grazing as a management tool. Not what the prerequisite that to be just profitable for grazing. It has to work for wildlife habitat.
And Mr. Chairman and members, that's a really important point, is that it's basically going to be based on that plan. And so I just have a couple just real short examples of things that we've done already and we've done in the past, and Scott kind of alluded to some of them. Staying away from, and there's hanging and there's grazing, and both will have different management potentials, as all of you are aware, and also they have definite different impacts on wildlife and wildlife habitat. So if we're doing agreeing to a haying plan, for instance, we'd be after the nesting season. We'd leave it at a certain height depending on the grass species and the slope of the land, etc. And we'd pull back and have it be completed early enough that we get enough regrowth so that we'd have grass there for fall and for next spring. Now, again, in our emergency situation we had this year, that's what we did. And then, of course, it didn't rain for two more months. So there could be situations where we didn't get the regrowth. But in very normal situations, when we stop doing an activity September 15th or whatever, or even sometimes August 30th, 31st, whatever, we'll get that regrowth. The other thing that Scott mentioned that is really pretty typical with really any type of grazing plants that we've been doing this for, we would do a proportional type of a thing. So in an area, we may allow a third of the site to be grazed or paid 1 year, a third the next year, and a third to, and I'm using these as examples, okay? So it's not, you know, all or nothing, if you will. But I will mention something else, too. And there's been a lot of work done by Nature Conservancy and DNR and Fish and Wildlife and others that are really starting to support the concept that we could live with ducks nesting and cows grazing right next to them. So very seldom will a cow actually step right on the egg and break that duck's egg in half, you know. But so we're not, from a grazing plant perspective, grazing versus haying is a lot different of an effect on the land also. So, but again, all those are really specific to the site and the grass and the slope and the other easements around it. If it's and as some of these pictures show, there's thousands of acres all around it with habitat too. We might be able to, but we will be able to manage it quite differently than if it's a standalone with crop land on four sides of it. So,
Scott,
couple questions, and I know these are kind of drafty things; they're not formalized. So, but I picked something out of there. You know, in Worthington, when they hire a school administrator, they hire him, and then after they hire him, they negotiate his salary, which I always figured was kind of odd. I just thought, how you did that before? But it even says that the entities and the grazer, the cooperator, will develop this grazing plan within 3 months of the grant of the easement. Okay, now that to me kind of sounds like negotiating somebody's salary after you've already hired them why wouldn't they know all the terms of that grazing agreement before they ever step in it? Because if you're doing it after the fact, then all of a sudden you get halfway through and says, I don't like that. You know, then you either compromise to some value that would be unacceptable to us, or the whole thing falls apart and you start over. Those easements and grazing agreements would be written in advance of signing the easement, would they not?
Mr. Chair, Scott, actually, yes. In this particular case in Minnesota, and it's very important to us that we make sure that the ultimate owner of the land is going to be very comfortable with what the conservation easement says. So even prior to us going out there and acquiring any of these lands, we're going to want to make sure that we have a buyer at the other end who is comfortable with the easement and something that we're comfortable with in terms of how it's going to work from a conservation standpoint. So even prior to buying those first pieces of land, we will have the easement and the management plan of those things drafted for their review, and they need to be able to sign off on it. Otherwise, it's going to be very difficult for us to put forth our own money to acquire these lands, not knowing, just what you're saying. We can get all through this process and think, I don't really like it, and we really don't have a buyer at the other end. So that's very important for us to get that squared away.
Would you be willing to make these easements not subject to those emergency hang things that are very comparable on many other type programs? Where, I mean, down in southwest Minnesota where there's almost no grass anyway, and then what little grass is out there, you drive out there and there's 150 roundhills where your one little pheasant spot used to be. Would these properties be eligible for emergency hang under some of those federal or statutes, or could we make these easements not eligible for that practice?
I think from a practical level, they're held by a nonprofit. There's no reason you can't put that provision in if you wanted to.
I would like to see that provision in.
And Mr. Chairman and members, this is a pilot. So, again, we didn't. I guess we'd probably rather not be dictated by the appropriation as to how the easement language or the recommendation from the council or other changes that you might want us to make the accomplishment plan that would be better. It's always dangerous when you put, you know, zero language, 100 or zero language in an easement and don't give any flexibility. But if that's what you would like us to do in this pilot approach, I think we're willing to. Yeah, I understand.
Would it take your interested parties to zero? Or is there enough interested parties out there you think we could get that done and still pull this off?
Mr. Chairman and Scott, I mean, here's just a couple of good examples. With the board, we have 6,500 easements, and during the emergency hang and grazing time that happened this past year, we only approved a little more than 100 emergency hang and grazing 2 to 3, 4 week use of that grassland. So I don't think that it would necessarily pull very many people out of the negotiations. Steve,
I would just say that the folks that I'm talking to, they understand. I've said it about 100 times that the bottom line is at no point can the conservation values for this property be compromised. It has to always be functioning as habitat. So I guess that's how I would answer that. That they can't do anything that would be, you know, hay, so that destroys it as grassland habitat. Provision not viable as grassland habitat, and that's stuff that they couldn't do.
Of the 100 that you approved, 95 of those must have been in Nobles County.
And Mr. Chair, maybe I can just add on behalf of the Minnesota Land Trust, it would not be typical for our easements, obviously, to have emergency provisions in that. So we would absolutely be fine with that.
Okay. More questions?
Good enough. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, I take it that the progressing of this grasslands accomplishment plan is contingent upon an amendment to what was presented to you to make the hang and grazing requirements not subject to emergency.
Correct.
So that would be an amendment that you'd want to make to the motion.
I need to make an amendment to the motion that that no emergency hang be allowed in those easements.
Mr. Chairman, just a technical, also remind Bill that
that would also need to be in the language, because the general law, for at least for the rim easements, the ones that would be held by the Board of Water and Soil Resources, there is an emergency provision in there, which they operated under this year. We would need, I think you'd want to actually in the language say, notwithstanding that they would not be subject to emergency aid. In the language in the rider.
Per Greg's recommendation.
Thank you. Right. Any discussion? All in favor of the amendment?
Aye.
Opposed? Members, I'd like to know what your feeling is about specifically directing that this not be something where profits are generated for the conservation fund. And if there's any excess money to go back into the project. And Bill, can we handle that if we would agree in the accomplishment plan? Do we need a motion to that? How would you?
With your advice, Kevin. Is that right?
Mr. Chair members, you could, do a motion and just include that as part of your council.
Okay. I'd make that motion that the accomplishment plan be amended to make it clear that any money that's generated from the transaction, which would be the total in the resale versus and the total in the easement, does not exceed the purchase price of the property, and if it does, that money goes back into the project. Any discussion?
Since we're looking at, let's say, 10 or 15, 20 different projects, they may lose money on one, and they may gain money on one. Are you saying that overall, when they're all done, that any excess would come back, or it's on a per-track basis?
I hadn't thought about it. I'm comfortable on a package.
Okay. I would agree with the package thing.
And one of the benefits of having someone with a fund is that they can play that game. But in the end, I'd like to do more projects, not see somebody else profit. And I suspect we would come under criticism if that were to be the case. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Great. Motion carries. Other projects that anybody would like to bring up and have discussed? Having read your tomb in front of you while you were in the duck flying, and there were no ducks flying this weekend. No other questions for anybody? All right, we'll vote on the motion to approve the package as amended by previous motion. All in favor of approving the accomplishment plans as presented and amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. Thank you all for coming and not having to speak. We appreciate that you made the effort, even though you weren't called upon. We never know where a question will come from. What it does mean is you did a great job collectively of giving us information that made sense. Because I actually know some people didn't read the materials very closely, and we would have had discussions.
Some of these individuals might want to stick around yet a little bit in case they have any input on the amended agenda item that we're going to talk about.
Okay, that's just fine. So if you have any interest in potentially being heard about the public
recreation information max.
You can stick around, and we may or may not call.
Wayne? Mr. Chair, I don't know if this is a problem, but I recently submitted a question, three questions to you, which I asked Riggs and Janelle to look into, and it does have to do something with the private entities, which we, in a land acquisition, and I want to just get this clarified for myself. For instance, we have the Audubon, or the Arboretum, and under their rules, they have membership
to the Arboretum. And they said in this, in the last board on here, on the property that we were looking at funding, that they would forego the requirement of a membership fee on that. And you, and I think it was mentioned that although it doesn't prevent them from doing that, because you mentioned that state parks, for instance, even though we use funding for this, you do state parks can require a annual sticker in order to be able to use the property. So my question comes back on private, on non-public entities, in NGOs, whatever, if they are the recipient of funds to purchase the property, can they come back and require a user fee, or could they come back and require that the user fee be granted to access the property? Or is that not possible?
Now,
Mr. Chair, I don't think a user fee would be considered open to the public. For public taking of the Fish and Wildlife. I think they would need to be clear. I think the important thing is that the accomplishment plan spell out the hunting and fishing availability. And that's part of your requirement now under the law, and that should be spelled out. And with the Arboretum, it should be right in the accomplishment plan that it will that they will not need to be a member of the Arboretum to do that. And I think they said that they would do that, but you should probably put that in the accomplishment plan.
Mr. Chair, I think that that's good advice. I think that you've got to remember that these lands are subject to the intended use and can be reclaimed if they're used as other than intended. And I'll put it on the record right now. I don't think anybody up to this point in time has anticipated that there would be charges for the use of this land. And therefore, that's not an intended use of past approved accomplishment plans to charge. And we'll make it explicit in the future ones.
Thank you. One of those things that came up all of a sudden, I was sitting there thinking about it, and I thought, gee, I really hope that we're not digging ourselves a pit here where we could potentially can have that problem.
Okay. Ian?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to leave, so I was just wondering if I could have like a privilege of the body just for a second.
Absolutely.
Okay. I just want to, I'm guessing this will probably be my last meeting with your folks. Oh, we do?
We do.
Okay, so I won't.
Hopefully your company will see if I
speak. Yeah.
I don't know if I can.
Yeah, the December meeting is that where we approve the actual legislative language that we recommend.
That's where I should have looked at that.
You won't.
Okay.
That's when cookies are served.
I'll pass.
Okay. With that, we'll move to the item that we added to the agenda, which is the Public Information Act map. Scott, would you, since this is your item, would you discuss it?
A question I have that I want to bring up for council consideration is, you know, when I was out and running around in Dakota, and you stop at any gas station and you pick up the big book and it lists every conceivable property in the entire state that's open for public hunting and fishing, whether it's fed lands, waterfowl protection, doesn't matter, they're all there. And Minnesota has a what's called a public recreation information map, which also lists all of the areas, you know, WMAs and those kinds of things. And I thought, you know, is every acquisition or every acquisition that we fund that's open for public hunting and fishing, do members of Minnesota, citizens of Minnesota, or any state for that matter, know how to find them? So I thought about Cass County. You know, we fund some property in Cass County. County lands are open. But do Cass County's county lands show up on the public recreation information map? Okay? And if they do, then people would find it. So my question came down to is, do all of our other NGOs that are buying land in fee title, are they required, or are they doing it on their own, or is it not being done, where those lands are owned in fee, open to public hunting and fishing, but have absolutely no way for Minnesota citizens to find them. And so I would like to make a open for discussion a possible motion where all lands acquired in fee have to be published on the Minnesota Recreation Information Map, so that when people are driving through Renville County, if there's a TNC acquisition over here, that means that they could, oh, it's right here, it's on the map, if I turn left and drive down a half a mile, there's a quarter section down there I can go hunt on. But if it's not, and it's not just TNC, it's everyone. You know, if DU buys a piece of land and puts owns X number of feet of shoreline for an outlet structure, and there is no other public access on that lake or limited, could somebody go there and sit on the shore and throw out three decoys as long as firearms discharge is allowed and duck hunt on that property? I would like to see all lands acquired by all entities included in any and all recreation maps that are available. And I don't think we can go back, but I would include in that request any all land, a voluntary inclusion of any and all lands purchased with the four prior appropriations that we funded. You know, we can't, you know, I think it's difficult to go retroactively back, but we would say any new lands acquired in fee have to be included on any and all maps, and a request from those same entities that all lands acquired with prior appropriations also be included on that. I think that's just really important, you know, as far as how people can find these spots. So I would like to add that to the final appropriation bill language, you know, and Greg can, or whoever can write that up, that's included, and hopefully would be included in every appropriation bill we would write going forward.
So Scott was nice enough to ask me if it was okay that he could add this to the agreement. So I have just that much more time to have thought about it than anyone else. My question is there any unintended consequence with the NGOs that own the property or with the state in how they manage that thing, that by us deciding to do it might create some dilemma, and does it make sense for us to ask questions and make sure that we don't run into some unknown before we do this? Scott was suggesting perhaps a suggestion versus a hard and fast rule. I'm wondering, Scott, whether or not it would make sense to put it on our agenda for the December meeting, have the appropriate language ready to go, in essence, and ask people to comment on it, the people running the maps or NGOs, before we actually take action, so that we're giving people an opportunity to respond to it before we just do it and discover something we didn't think about.
And that's one of the reasons I thought maybe some of these people would want to hang around. You know, and I understand that in some cases that might be the case. If you have a piece of property that's being rotationally grazed, okay, I mean, if there's cows on a fourth of it, then that spot's not open for public hunting that day. But, I mean, I know you go out. There's a something called the NRCS Research Station, which is in Cottonwood, South Dakota. And it's open for public hunting, but it's not come one, come all. You have to call a number. You know, you got to tell them what day you're coming, and they describe, you know, it's open to 10 people, it's first come, first serve, et cetera. You know, I don't doubt that there might be a little additional activity required on behalf of someone to do that, but I think the benefit to the public outweighs whatever little inconvenience that might be.
Right.
You know, it's a very nice common sense approach. I'm wondering if we could start by just asking the question on the proposal sheet. We ask all kinds of questions. You know, will this be open to hunting? So we could ask, will this be listed in any kind of public document as to availability? And if it's marked no, then we could ask the person why, or and do it that way. Start there instead of making it some kind of requirement. Of Scott's already mentioned a number of possible exceptions that could muddy the water.
Well, and the question that I have is whether the state will list private property or has some weird prohibition against doing that, in which case we could we'd be better off to ask them in advance if there's a problem. I don't have a clue.
And I'm totally okay with you know, bringing this up, ticking with the time between now and our next meeting, you know, to allow NGOs an opportunity to respond. You know, maybe now that staff's in a big lull, you know, maybe they could see whether or not there's any prohibitions on private property.
Is there in the current database any private property, Scott, that you know of?
Not to my knowledge.
No. So I would think the first question is there any reason why the state would have a problem doing it?
And I'm okay with that. I mean, can we dig up some of those things and then talk about it at the next meeting?
We certainly can ask the person from the state who runs that program or one of their designees to come to our next meeting and talk about it.
We got that.
Is that all right with everyone? I think it's a great idea. I just want to make sure we don't go off and discover that our great idea wasn't quite as great as we thought it was. So you're okay if we bring some, and we'll put it as an agenda item on our next agenda so that anybody who has an opinion about it can also decide they want to have a conversation. All right.
Very good.
Just one thing, Sandy. I gave you that notice on this conservation meeting. I think everybody got that. Just wondering, is this it looks like a interesting form that's going to be handled around the state. It's a Minnesota Environmental Congress. I'd like to attend the one in Moorhead on the December 14th. I'm wondering if the rest of the council members are interested in attending these and participating. You've seen the directive, so just any input on it? Is it something we should do on our own, or is it something that we as
a... You're talking to the guy who never puts in a per diem, so I'd say do it on your own, but I'm very flexible on this. If you want to go, go. I think it's appropriate for the council members to be able to go to that.
Where are they?
There are six different locations around the state.
Rochester, November 27th, Bloomington, November 17th, Duluth, November 28th, Washington, Worthington, December 10th, St. Cloud, December 12th, Moorhead, December 14th.
So, do you have that in your email box? Or no? Can the staff send it out?
I got this from Bill.
Oh.
Right? Oh, wait a minute. No, I got it from the DNR.
It came from
Joyce.
The DNR.
No. If staff would please circulate it, I'll take this as a council willing to reimburse costs and the meeting if that's what people want to do.
Mr. Chair, we'll more or less copy PDF and circulate.
Okay. Anything else? Do we have any public comments? If anyone has said they'd like to
contact us.
Does anyone from the public want to make a comment? I'm not seeing any going to the front. We are adjourned. Thank you all.